Welcome to Cal State University Domingo Hills. We're coming live to you here from Cal State University Domingo Hills and live on TV locally and on the internet worldwide. This is the SBS 318 course on Islamic culture and civilization. And I'm your instructor, Asadullah Khan. Welcome and peace be unto you. Today we are dealing with the mosque, a symbol of faith and an expression of Islamic civilization. I would like to start by thanking the callers and those who have emailed us with kind compliments and for the positive comments. We appreciate your kind sentiments and thank you very much for the encouragement and the questions and the contributions that you have made so far. And I would welcome the guests to log on as well as to call in as well as to go online and get in touch and ask questions and contribute to the program. And in that way, we can better foster understanding and build relationships and perhaps tolerance and appreciation of one another. As I mentioned, the topic for today's discussion is the mosque, a symbol of faith and an expression of Islamic civilization. It is reported that Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, said, whenever a person finds himself, at the time of prayer, let him pray. Now, this conviction that the earth is a mosque may be seen in many Muslim contexts, in conformity with the statement of the Prophet. Muhammad is not unusual in that he has said that the whole place is a mosque, but the idea that a specific place of worship is not required for prayer in Islam, this indeed is a unique statement in that regard. And therefore, though Muslims pray in particular places, the idea is that there's not a requirement for a particular building for a place. However, mosques have been built throughout history, even in the time of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. In fact, the area adjacent to his home in Medina was the first mosque. So when we speak of the mosque, we realize that first of all, it is regarded as a place of worship, and more than just the place of worship, it is also an expression of Islamic faith, a manifestation of Islamic presence, but also an access of the community of believers. Now, having said that, we need to also understand that the mosque is a place of worship, but not the house of God. In that I mean that the mosque doesn't house any relics which are regarded as being sacred or sacrosanct in particular. It is a place of worship, and people throughout the world go and pray as a very simple structure. Sometimes it has elaborate designs in it, but it doesn't contain any relics or anything of that sort regarded as sacred or something like an altar which is dedicated to God or anything of that sort. It's purely a simple prayer, place of prayer and a place of worship. When we travel throughout the world, we'll find that mosques have been established for the worship of God and also as an access of the community. From one end of the Islamic world to the other, Muslim presence can be readily identified by the domes and the minarets of the mosques where the faithful are called to prayer five times a day. And of all Muslim institutions, the most important place for the public expression of Islamic religiosity and communal identity is the mosque. The mosque is a physical manifestation of the public presence of Muslims and serves as a point of convergence for Islamic social and intellectual activity. The word mosque in Arabic is actually masjid, and the word masjid means a place of prostration to God. The word prostration in Arabic is sajda, and masjid is the place where one prostrates to God or before God. And mosques are mentioned in the Quran, and the earliest model, of course, is the mosque of the Prophet, which I have made reference to early on. It needs to be understood that mosques punctuate virtually every city or every town in the world, and sometimes even in desert areas, remote areas, we find mosques punctuating the skylines or even the barren land. As Islam spread outside Arabia, Islamic architecture was influenced by various architectural styles of the conquered lands. And both simple and monumental mosques of striking beauty were built in cities of the Islamic world. We see there in the foreground now a mosque recently built in Australia. Despite the borrowing from diverse civilizations, certain common features became characteristic of most mosques and thus served to distinguish them from the sacred spaces of other cultures and religions. I have mentioned that minarets punctuate the skyline of cities worldwide, a fact which should not be surprising given the fact that Muslims comprise around 1/5 of the world's population, that is 1.2 billion Muslims worldwide, and constitute a majority in more than 40 nations of the Middle East, Asia, and of course, Africa. The voice of the caller to prayer, or the muezzin, is still heard emanating 5 times daily from the tops of minarets in every city, in every town, in every village, summoning the faithful to prayer in every corner of the world, even at the beginning of the 21st century. The mosque also is an expression of Islamic art and architecture. And as we see the mosque in the background, there we have a mosque, we have seen one in Malaysia, and now we have the mosque there in Timbuktu in Mali, one of the ancient mosques, and a mosque which we will refer to later on, which became a great center of learning and one of the great libraries of Islam, and produced some of the greatest scholars in the history of Islam. Now, architecture sometimes, of course, not sometimes, but in most occasions, reflect the universal expression of artistry of any ideology or philosophy. Architecture was universally the most important form of Islamic art after writing and the recitation of the Quran, calligraphy and qira'ah, or in Arabic, khat, which is the calligraphy, and qira'ah, which is the recitation of the Quran, which we have dealt with last week. Though the mosques cost the most, and there we see a mosque, what they call the Pearl Mosque in India, made purely of marble, white marble. It cost the most, mosques by themselves cost the most, but they also lasted the longest. And the mosque was seen by the widest audience. Buildings built for religious purposes, primarily mosques, colleges, madrasas or centers of learning, as well as libraries or maktabs, are often the best known and best preserved because they are continuously used, and they continue to be used and maintained over the centuries. There we see a beautiful mosque in Turkey overlooking the Bosphorus. Religious buildings may provide the framework for tracing the development of Islamic art and Islamic architecture. So as I mentioned, architecture was universally the most important, amongst the most important form of Islamic of art. It cost the most, but it lasted the longest, as well as was seen by the widest audience. And in that way, the mosque is a manifestation of Islamic art at its highest level. When we look at the mosque there in China, as an example, we see a variety and how particular cultures influenced the structures of mosque. The whole idea of Islam not imposing itself, or the ideology of Islam, or the philosophy of Islam, not imposing a particular specific paradigm as regards structure, is indicated by the variety that we have seen so far, reflecting in the various mosques, from Medina to the deserts of Oman to China, as we have seen, Timbuktu in Africa, and so on, and Australia. When considering the architecture of the mosque and the presence of mosques all over the world, in Southern California alone, over 60 Islamic centers and mosques, it is perhaps appropriate to begin by asking why, outside the world of the Muslim, and even sometimes within it, how come so little is known about the architectural heritage of the mosque? What makes a mosque a mosque? We are going to visit one of the well-known mosques in Los Angeles and have a tour thereof to have a basic idea of what a mosque is. This is the mosque in Culver City, Los Angeles. The hustle and bustle of downtown Los Angeles. We are now in the area of Culver City, and at the entrance of one of the well-known mosques in Los Angeles, in Culver City. And as we can see, we are at the entrance of the masjid, of the mosque. And basically, the word masjid in Arabic means a place of prostration, and is the Arabic title for the place of worship. And all over the world, places of worship are called masjid, or in English, mosques. One of the features of a mosque is, very often when you enter, you'll find writing and verses of the Quran inscribed on the walls. And this is somewhat a break from the rest of the worldly affairs. We're entering virtually into a kind of a spiritual realm, though of this world, and somewhat reminding us of the other world. We enter from the hustle bustle of the worldly life into a spiritual center, which is also the center and the axis of the community of faith. It's not only a place of prayer, but also a place of socializing, of spiritually enlightening oneself, also intellectual enlightenment, but also coming together to learn and to impart learning, to receive some kind of spiritual nourishment and intellectual nourishment and social cohesiveness and consciousness. So when we look at the beautiful artwork, we find here geometric designs, reflecting the beauty of nature, the accuracy and the permanence somewhat of structure in some way, but yet reminding us of the ultimate permanence, which is that of the Creator, and realizing that as we enter into the mosque, we are welcomed with the words of God inscribed on the walls, reminding us constantly of our responsibility and our duty as human beings in relation to the Creator and in relation to the rest of creation as well. So here we are at the entrance, and as we are entering from the hustle and bustle of the city life, we enter into the realm of the spiritual as well as into the realm of the calm and the serene. And this is one of the purposes of a masjid, of a mosque, a place of worship. And as we enter, we'll see different elements and components of the mosque that add and enhance this whole idea of spirituality, this whole idea of community, and the whole idea of intellectual and moral advancement. Let's enter. As we enter into the mosque now, we'll find that we are entering to what they call the Sahan, which is virtually the courtyard area. And very often in some mosques in the world, it's a very large part of the mosque, and very often activities were held regarding training, sport training, as well as physical exercises, even preparation of the army sometimes, or self-defense and so on and so forth. So it was an integral part of the mosque. Of course, here in the urban setting, we don't have a big courtyard. Nonetheless, you will find as you enter, you enter into an area which has, on all four sides perhaps, we have an upper section where there are classrooms and things where people are taught. But at the same time, as you can see, verses of the Holy Quran written all around on the walls that we have here. If you perhaps have a look at the writing, and then you have the dome through which the light enters. So you find a degree of serenity immediately, that you're entering into an area, a space somewhat serene, somewhat quiet, somewhat peaceful, and automatically it's quite different from the world outside that we have. The globe, the world, the heavens, upwards, firm square structure at the bottom, flat earth, or flat ground rather, on a circular earth, but upwards towards the divine, somewhat inspiration, somewhat reflective. And when we look at the artwork itself, it's also an embodiment of the beauty and the majesty of the Creator reflected in the writing. And the words written here are the words of the Quran, which is the revelation that Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, received, as were received by prophets before him, peace be upon all of them. We are observing people are gathering for prayer. Of course, there is in the mosque a demarcation. The men pray very often either on the one side, men and the ladies separated. Sometimes the ladies pray upstairs and the men downstairs, but they follow the, f- the same prayer leader and perform the same prayer. So this is part of what we are seeing here. We are now in what you call the courtyard of the mosque, and then we are to enter the mosque proper where the prayer is performed as we go ahead. We have now, for example, the prayer area, some of the part of the prayer area. We find some of the ladies praying on this side. Of course, as I mentioned, there's a demarcation of the prayer area. And on the other side, you find the men praying. The prayer, of course, following one leader, prayer leader, which is the imam. And as we enter the mosque proper, we find people entering into the prostration. There are people in prayer, following the prayer leader. This is the area, or they call the haram, or the prayer area proper, where the prayer is performed. As we can now see that the prayer is over. This is a late afternoon prayer, and we don't have too many people on a Sunday afternoon at the mosque at the moment. And you find people have just completed the prayer, some are meditating. And now we can also see there are shelves with books or religious literature or Quran and so on, and sometimes people will take from there and read just for spiritual blessings or just for reflection and for introspection. And you find, for example, someone, the prayer is over, but just beseeching God for mercy or forgiveness and so on. This is just an individual prayer which can be done at any time, as we see, for example, a person doing. One of the things that we notice here in the masjid, in the mosque, that there's a total absence of any human or animal figures. The idea is to keep a focus completely on the Creator, the Almighty, and to minimize any reflection of animals or specifically of human beings. And therefore there are no pictures here of any human being, nor any figurines whatsoever. Also, as we see, there are no altars in the mosque. And there's no reserved place except for the prayer leader who prays in the area called the mihrab. And as I go towards the mihrab, you would realize that this is the niche, or the prayer niche. The niche always shows the direction towards Mecca. Wherever we are in the world, we pray towards the Kaaba, the mosque re-established by Abraham, which is still the center of towards which Muslims pray and worship, and also the center for pilgrimage, which Muslims go towards once in their lifetime. And the pilgrimage, of course, which occurs in the 12th month of the Islamic calendar, the month of Zulhijjah, or the month of pilgrimage. So here we see the prayer niche, or the mihrab, and this shows the direction towards Mecca. So the prayer leader prays in here, and those who follow the prayer stand in straight lines facing towards Mecca. So wherever Muslims are, they face in the direction of Mecca, and this shows the Qibla, the direction of prayer. So this is the mihrab, the prayer niche, where the imam or the prayer leader stands and people follow him. And of course the mosque, there are people praying here. And on Fridays, when the mosque is overflows, we find also people praying upstairs. If you look, for example, there are areas demarcated for prayer, and people can observe from there as well and pray and have access in that way. So as we can see, there's a congregational side to prayer and also an individual side to prayer, that people pray in congregation, which are the five obligatory prayers. But any time a person wishes to come and pray, of course you can pray anywhere in the world, but congregational prayer is done in congregation itself, and that is five times a day. And at least once a week, Muslims are obligated to pray in congregation, and that prayer is Friday at noon. In that prayer, of course, the imam also gives what they call a khutbah, or a sermon, and then he ascends the pulpit. He goes up. Sometimes the ascension is from the front, and sometimes in this case there's a stairway from here leading towards behind the mihrab onto the minbar, and the imam or the khatib addresses the congregation from there. Very often, of course, the mihrab is adjacent, or at least next to the minbar, and most often the ascension, or there is a stairway leading upwards to the minbar, from where the imam addresses the congregation. In this case, we have a stairway going behind the mihrab and to the top, from where the imam addresses the congregation. And I'm going up on the stairway towards the top, And here we are, right on top. And it's from here that the Imam would address the congregation. And the importance of the minbar that we have here is that first of all, it's a elevation so that everyone can see the person, and secondly, also it's a focus of attention that the listeners focus towards the speaker. In days gone by, in the time of the Prophet, peace be upon him, and subsequent to that, in the absence of speakers and mics and sound systems, of course, it also is a way of projecting one's voice. So the higher you are, the easier it is to communicate to a larger audience, even if they be distant, even if they be a distant from you. So this is the pulpit, for want of a better word, from which the imam would address the congregation. And most mosques would have a pulpit of some kind, sometimes just an ordinary staircase, sometimes just two or three stairs on which the imam stands, and sometimes an elaborate one like this one that we see here in Culver City. So we have the mihrab, which shows the direction to prayer. Every mosque would have that, or the niche, which is called the qibla, directing one towards Mecca. And then, of course, we have the minbar, from which the imam or the khatib, the speaker, addresses the congregation. This is primarily used on Friday, but could be used on any occasion when there is a large congregation, as we see. And people from above can also view the imam if they wish and participate in the program itself. As once again, there's no altar at all in the mosque, and there's no place reserved for anyone at all except for the prayer leader who leads the prayer. There's no area demarcated for any particular person. In fact, Islam does not recommend the idea of reserving any part of the mosque for any particular person. Now, we find, of course, there are pillars that uphold the structure. But in some centers, like in Al-Azhar in Cairo and many other parts of the world, in Kairouan, in West Africa, you'd find that sometimes these pillars were also used as spots from which, or areas from which, particular sciences were taught. You'd find sometimes in some parts of the world, at a particular spot, a particular scholar would regularly give lectures. So he would sit on the chair, and the students gather around the scholar, and he would answer their questions, or speak to them, or advise them, or teach them some particular science, whether the prophetic tradition, whether it be Quranic interpretation, whether it be grammar, whether it be philosophy, whether it be mathematics. These were taught sometimes, not sometimes, always, but sometimes particular pillars were demarcated for a particular scholar, and so on. You'd find in some parts of the world it was very often the case, where the mosque also served as a comprehensive center of learning, and virtually each pillar had a history. The pillar where science was taught, the pillar where Quran was taught, where hadith was taught. For example, you'd find a chair, and the scholar sits around the student sits around the scholar and benefit from his learning. That still continues in some parts of the world, like in Egypt, in Syria, in Iran, and some other parts of the world. We still have that in practice. One of the things that we also notice is we look at the dome above here. It's very elaborate. Basically, we see a squarish structure, a flat surface, squarish structure, very defined. And then we go to the dome, which is round, no beginning, no end. And makes one reflect on the majesty of the creation of the Creator. No beginning, no ending. We find verses of the Quran, geometric and floral designs, and they are in here. We find verses of the Quran written, which are indicating the majesty of God, also how we are dependent on God, and at the same time what we ought to do and what we ought to avoid doing. These are some of the small sections of verses that are there. So as we look up, we reflect on that. We reflect on the majesty of the Creator. We reflect on our responsibility to the Creator. We also realize the higher purpose of life. It also serves, by the way, architecturally, to throw one sound is also a means of enhancing the echo of the sound. And in some mosques, in ancient mosques, you'll find that these domes also served as a means of enhancing the sound itself. Even on the lights that you find here, the chandelier somewhat, they are also verses of the Quran or testimonies to faith, or for example, Subhanallah, Subhanal Malik al-Quddus, and so on, which basically imply that glory to Allah, glory to God the Most High. So the dome is also somewhat an essential structure of many of the mosques globally. And you find these are the basics of the mosque. The entrance that we find, then the area which is the courtyard somewhat, sometimes just a place where people discuss things, sometimes a place where people used to study, where they used to practice and do exercises and physical training or debates at time, whole court sometimes, and the mosque itself, place of prayer, place of learning, place of reflection. And of course, as you have seen, there are no figurines, there are no altars, no reservations, no place reserved for anyone. Very, very basic, very, very simple. Anyone is welcome at any time. And this is what it captures here. And as we look above the mihrab, it captures in essence the whole spirit of God consciousness. It says in Arabic, وَلِلَّهِ الْمَشْرِقُ وَالْمَغْرِبُ, and unto God belongs the heavens and the earth on the one side, but here it implies the east and the west. We have seen verses outside reflecting that the heavens and the earth belong to God, and in this particular verse, unto God belongs the east and the west. So in other words, wherever we are on the domain of God, not only in the mosque. So as we leave the mosque, we keep that in mind. Also, we find some of the motifs and the designs, some of the words that we find, for example, in blue, the word Allah in Arabic, in calligraphy, beautiful calligraphy, and you'll find it throughout the mosque. So wherever you are, you're reminded of God, you are removed from the idea of your own grandeur and your own importance, but rather reflecting on your relationship with the Creator Himself. And as we exit the mosque, we are now coming again back into the courtyard area. And here again, for example, you'd find there are classrooms on the one side. We will go to one of the libraries. Very often, the library was an integral part of the mosque because the mosque was also a learning center. And as you would see, for example, we have racks for the shoes. Obviously, when you enter the place of worship, you remove your shoes in the courtyard before you enter the mosque. We're walking on carpets right now, and these carpets are always kept clean. And that's why as you enter the mosque, you remove your shoes, and you can see the racks that are there, also an integral part of the mosque structure. Removing the shoes, putting them on the rack in an orderly fashion, and then entering barefoot, or rather without shoes, into the mosque. And you'd find that when we enter the mosque, we are without shoes. And then once again back on top, you'll see there are classrooms on top. This is in the courtyard area, the various classrooms on top, and these classrooms serves as teaching centers, various subjects, not only so-called religious subjects, but various other sciences, public speaking, leadership programs, and so on and so forth, discussion on ethics, and even sometimes, even here we have classes in many of the mosques in Los Angeles on mathematics and science, revision for students, and so on and so forth. All forms of learning, but with a idea of God consciousness and trying to enhance our understanding of the Creator and of creation as a whole. And as we look from the courtyard now, we enter into one of the many classrooms that we have here, or the rooms. And here in this case, we have what is an integral part normally of mosques throughout the world and throughout history, where you have centers of learning, for example. And here we have a kind of a research center, and we find a variety of books. Much of these are in Arabic, by the way. You have books very often as well in English and other languages. But here, research various books on grammar, on interpretation of the Quran, on traditions of the Prophet, on issues of Islamic law, Islamic morality, questions about daily life and issues, contemporary issues, and so on. And here we have, for example, a place where people could sit down and do some research. And this is the environment in very often which learning took place. This is what we need to understand, that it's an integral part. And you can see it's virtually part of the mosque. You feel the same kind of serene atmosphere. And Islam has never made a dichotomy between learning, the sciences, and God. There was never a dichotomy and there was never that conflict. And that's why it was easy for the civilization to assimilate the issues of science and faith and not to be contentious regarding those issues. And that somewhat catapulted the whole idea of Islamic civilization at a global level and gave it a tremendous amount of impetus. So here we can see, for example, a variety of literature from throughout history, from great scholars, which some of them have been reproduced, of course, in modern print, and the great works of Islamic literature, Islamic interpretation, Islamic thought, Islamic philosophy, and these are the centers from which people learn. Of course, I think in the past, it was much more a center of learning than it is now, and there are some efforts made to re-establish that kind of setting. And here we see an effort in that regard. So then also the library and the research center, an integral part of the mosque. Here we have an interesting piece in this mosque here, for example. This is a golden thread calligraphy written on black cloth. And this is a portion of the cloth that covers the Kaaba. Every year they change the cloth. And they put a new one, of course, the same kind with the same pattern. And here we have golden thread calligraphy of Quranic verses, and this is a portion of the black cloth from the mosque in Mecca, the Kaaba, which the cloth which covers the Kaaba, the Kaswa, and this we have a piece of it here from Mecca as a gift to the center. So it also somehow sometimes serves as a place where we have some historical relics as well. This is, of course, the library and the research center, which is part of the mosque. We are back on the outside of the mosque again, and here we see, for example, as we exit the mosque, one of the notable features of the mosque, we cannot see the dome from the side, but we can see the minaret. And the minaret is a tall structure originally from which the muadhin, or the caller of prayer, used to ascend to call the people to pray. It's not used so much nowadays in the contemporary world, specifically in the West, as a place from which the muadhin calls his prayer. Very often they have a mic system that does that. But still it's a symbol of a mosque, the presence of a mosque, very tall, seen from a great distance. And as you can see, there are verses of the Quran inscribed on it. So it is somewhat an expression of an Islamic presence. And also the idea of the minaret being like a one symbol, signifying the oneness of God, almost as a testimony that there's only one God. And this is some part of the symbolism of the minaret, and God knows best. So this is the idea. We exit the mosque and we see the minaret, and some mosques in the world have numerous minarets, like in Turkey and so on. And this is part of the structure of the mosque and somewhat reflects the presence, even from a distance, of a place of worship. We have basically covered the essential mosque. However, one of the central features of a mosque is also the ablution area, which we haven't covered in here, but in our discussion, of course, we will elaborate on the ablution area as well, the place where people clean themselves, an essential part that before you enter prayer, you cleanse yourself to physically purify yourself and psychologically purify yourself for a spiritual meeting with the Creator. This is the mosque, place of worship, an expression of Islamic presence wherever you find a masjid. In other words, a place of prostration to God. That was our visit to Kaaba City, and we thank Islamic City for the videotaping there, and we're grateful to the people at the mosque for allowing us the permission to video, and we thank them very much on behalf of the Social Behavioral Science Department here at Cal State University, Domingo Hills. We are back live at Cal State University, Domingo Hills, for the SBS 318 program on Islamic culture and civilization. We are online, domingosonline.csudh.edu. And you can call us, please, if you wish. You can call us, you can email us. We are eager to listen, to hear from you. And please feel free to pass any comments or suggestions, or to ask any questions that you may have. Now, as we have seen from the mosque, from the tour that we had of the mosque, a very brief and basic tour of a mosque here in Los Angeles, a mosque built very recently in the last 5 years or so, a contemporary mosque right on the westernmost coast of the Western world here in Culver City in Los Angeles, California. Now, one of the things we mentioned earlier on is that mosques are not houses of God. They shelter neither images of God, which are forbidden, any images of that nature, for there is no image of God, by the way, nor altars. Rather, they are somewhat, in essence, places reserved for communal prayer and as an access for the community of faith. Now, one of the things that we need to understand, and as we in the next few minutes elaborate a bit on each of the components of the mosque and some of its symbolism, we must realize that neither the Quran nor the prophetic tradition contain any specification about the construction of a mosque. In other words, it doesn't have to have all these, the minaret or the dome or the niche for it to be a mosque. It must be clearly understood that any square place, any open area for that matter, could be a mosque as well. Any demarcated area could be regarded as a particular place of worship. Now, at the end there, we made reference to the minaret. The minaret is a tall tower, you know, from which the muadhin or the caller to prayer used to call people to pray. And here we see a minaret from Africa, for example. The caller to prayer would five times a day climb to the top of the tower. There's a stairways inside normally, and go to the top and call the believers to prayer. And there's something unique about the first call to prayer. And there we see Al-Azhar, one of the great centers of Islamic learning, which has a university over 1,000 years old, one of the continuously used universities in the world. One of the longest continuously used universities in the world. We find that there's something slightly unique about the first person who was a caller to, who called to prayer. His name was Bilal, and he was a former African slave who was liberated by the Prophet Muhammad's friend, and then, of course, a close companion of the Prophet, peace be upon him. He was one of the first people to accept Prophet Muhammad's message. And as a slave, his decision to accept the new religion at that time in Mecca was opposed by his owner, who exposed him to inhuman torture and suffering, often dragging him through the streets, through the hot desert sands of Mecca, with a stone placed on his stomach, requesting him to recant his faith. Strangely enough, a few years later, this erstwhile downtrodden slave was boldly announcing that same message in Medina, the city of Medina, to which the Prophet Muhammad moved with his followers, and Bilal was one of the companions who moved with him to Medina. The call to pray in Islam is certainly a rousing call to humanity, which continues to be heard throughout the world. Every time Muslims hear it, it conjures up the symbol of Bilal's call to the world, and therefore, you'll find that mosques throughout the world have one or more towers from which the muezzin used to, or sometimes still calls, the faithful to prayer. In addition to their function and use, these minarets have become distinguishing elements of mosque architecture. And as we can see, the variety of them, sometimes sharp-pointed, sometimes square, sometimes round-shaped. In large mosques in particular, minarets have the effect of tempering the enormity of the magnificence of the dome structure by conveying to the viewer the elevation of divinity above the pretensions of human grandeur. The call to prayer was an important part of the early religious sense of Islam. The original call to prayer brought the believers together for worship and symbolically formed them into the first community. Even today, at the end of the 20th and the beginning of the 21st century, the call to prayer still represents a crucial symbolic act, establishing an Islamic presence in any village, town, city or country where it is heard. The mosque may be a physical symbol of Islam, writes Dr. Abdul Qadir Tayyib from the University of Cape Town in South Africa. He says, the mosque may be a physical symbol of Islam, but the call to prayer is a ritual act which sets that symbol into motion by calling people together. The call to prayer beckons the believers to worship. The call also has appropriated a new meanings and significations, which have become as much part of Islam as the act of bringing people together and also of announcing the presence of the community. Now, together with minarets, another structure, another feature of mosques generally is the dome. You find the circular dome very often, you find it over mosques. And there we have one, the Qubba, or the dome that you find over mosques. And that mosque, I think, is in Iran or Iraq, in the Persian Gulf area. Now, most mosques, many mosques in many parts of the world, in Africa in particular, and in Middle East, and even in the Far East, have a dome. And the line connecting the center of the dome to the niche is supposed to point towards Mecca. But throughout the world, there are many mosques that have these domes. And of course, somehow it indicates the limitlessness of the sky, and also indicates the unending mercy and grandeur of the Supreme Being. That this mosque in which you worship is sort of covered. It's in, sort of entombed somewhat, not entombed perhaps, but covered in a round manner with an oval shape, indicating no beginning, no ending. That it almost conjures up the idea of the heavens and the earth as limitless, and the creator of that above as the heavens and earth. Of course, in Islam, the idea that God is not limited to a particular place or space, that the authority of God extends all over the heavens and the earth. But the issue is that it indicates somewhat a symbol of the limitlessness of what is above over the limitations of the square and the triangular and the rectangular shapes that are clearly defined below. This is some of the symbolism of the dome that we have mentioned. The other thing, the other feature that we notice is the doorway. When you enter into many of the ancient and even some of the contemporary mosques, the doorway, or the bab meaning the gate or the doorway, and you find that very often it's almost as if the mosque is hidden until you enter the doorway and suddenly a new world opens up. Now this doorway somewhat serves as a barrier, not to prevent people from entering the mosque, by the way, but as a barrier from the, shall we say, the frivolous to the more spiritual, to the more serious, to the more to the higher level rather than the lower level. And you find that the doorway is an entrance into another realm of this world, but also connected to the other world somewhat. And you find here we have a picture, a photograph of an ancient entrance in a desert city, not even used anymore in the Central Asia, in Central Asia perhaps, and perhaps the mosque is not even anymore used, but somehow you can see it stands a testimony as to the serenity of what lies behind it and beyond it. So we understand that the doorway had an essential feature in that it was very artistically decorated. Geometric designs, sometimes even verses of the Quran, very often, is in the case of this one that we see here now. This is one of the entrances to a major mosque in Iran, for that matter. You find that it almost indicated that you're entering now from the mundane into the spiritual, from the lower to a higher level somewhat, to say. And it also evoked the one who enters to a heightened level of consciousness and of awareness as he or she enters the masjid or the mosque, the place of prostration, the place of worship. Now, as we can see as well in some of the other photographs, as we see here, for example, one of the entrances to a mosque, I think this is in Africa perhaps, where the entrance is sort of leading one's frame of mind as you enter, a degree of serenity and peace and tranquility as you're about to enter the area. Remember, the mosque is a very basic structure, but it's almost as if one is in preparation to enter to the meeting of one's Lord. But remember that the mosques are not houses of God in literal sense, that God resides in the mosque. No, but the idea is almost a preparation for that meeting of a heightened level of consciousness of one who's to meet his or her creator five times a day. And in this way, you find that people come from different corners in different ways. And here we see one above the entrance of the mosque in Cordova in Spain. And you can see the artistic design and the geometric design here. Unbelievable and, of course, unique. This all geometric designs with some Quranic words of God and words of Allah and praise to Allah intertwined with geometric design above the entrance to the mosque in Cordova. So from what the scheme we can see, we are sort of ushered in. We sort of gently ushered in from the hustle bustle of the material world into a more serene area, and that it prepares oneself psychologically and mentally for that. As one enters the doorway and one enters into the mosque, very often you'd enter into what we would call the sahan or the courtyard. And this is very significant for us to note, because very often the courtyard area was where much of the activity, remember, the mosque wasn't only a place of worship. And there we see a beautiful example that once you enter into a courtyard, this is, I think, the mosque in Egypt, the large courtyard before entering to all those to the dome, to the domed area where the mosque is, but in the foreground, the courtyard. And this is the place very often where discussions took place, learning took place, sometimes sporting activity, people used to practice and train, dispatching of maybe the army at times, or listening to the plaints of people. Sometimes juridical decisions were taken there, as well as counseling people to place there where it was open and so on and so forth. They're engaging in even somewhat a degree of socializing between people took place in that way also. So it provided, besides the prayer portion itself, for which the mosque is known, but in addition to that, for the other activities which are part of the larger social dimension of the community, which could be entertained somewhat in the mosque. All those wholesome and good activity which builds the community and strengthens the community spirit. And that, of course, is the courtyard. In the courtyard also, we would have very often an ablution area. And in the ablution area, this is the spot where people used to perform the ablution. As we know, before we enter into prayer, you must be in a condition of purity. Though physically one may be pure, but it's a more of a psychological and a spiritual preparation for entering into prayer, for one's meeting with one's creator, so to say. And here we find, for example, this is perhaps in Morocco, where we find a fountain. Sometimes there were small fountains, sometimes they were large, and sometimes they were like pools of water. Sometimes the mosques were near streams. Now, in conformity with the Quranic injunction and the prophetic emphasis on ritual purifications, mosques throughout the world incorporate some form of water system in their architecture. And classical mosque you'd find adorned with exquisite pools and fountains, and one had to very often pass through the water-based fixtures in order to get inside the mosque. And here we have a beautiful example of an ablution facility somewhere in West Africa. And this idea that God loves those who repent, and God loves those who are merciful, and those who are humble, and those who purify themselves. The reference, therefore, we find to purification is not only a physical thing, but is regarded as a moral as well as an ethical imperative. Now, from the ablution facility, we would find now in the courtyard, we enter now into the mosque proper, for want of a better word, sometimes called the haram, though it doesn't mean it's sacred area. The haram implies the sacred area, but sometimes referred to it as such, or the prayer area. And here we find the scholars who differ for the using the word haram for prayer area, but nonetheless, this is the area of the mosque proper, so to say, where prayer took place. And here we see a picture of a basic mosque in Africa, somewhere in Central Africa, for example, where we have, this is the prayer area of the mosque, and the front portion is a niche, which we will speak about a bit later on. And you must realize this is essentially the place where people prayed, but also where they sat together and reflected and sometimes contemplated on God and also the duties and responsibilities, and just to reflect on the day thus far, what they have done and what needs to be done for the rest of the day or for the rest of one's life. A place for introspection and reflection. And the mosque somewhat is conducive to that. Here we see the interior of the mosque in Cordova in Spain, for example. And one of the main feature of the prayer area is that, of course, you pray, you perform salah, which is the prayer. And salah may justifiably be regarded as a supreme form of devotion and obedience to God. The definition of a mosque as a place of prostration tries to create a spatial and temporal context in which such an ideal may be sought and realized. And therefore we see that salah, and there we see a beautiful picture of the interior of a mosque in Spain, we see that salah or prayer punctuates the temporal dimension of a person's existence in this world. It punctuates the temporal dimensions of a person's existence. For we pray five times a day, just before sunrise, just after noon, mid-afternoon, just after sunset, and then later in the evening. So one virtually punctuates the temporal dimension of a person's existence through daily prayer. Also remember that not only prayer were held in the mosque, but also there were commemorative events, celebratory events, sometimes celebrating the Laylatul Qadr, for example, the odd nights of the last 10 nights of Ramadan. And here we see a beautiful example of the interior of a mosque in Turkey, which is still in use, of course, a magnificent mosque in Turkey. The idea is that the mosque was used, the haram area or the prayer area, not only for prayer, but also on occasions for commemorative events like Laylatul Qadr in some, or for the performance of Eid prayer, or for celebration in that way, or sometimes for the for congregational or for prayer for congregational supplication for people who may have passed on, or the performance of funeral prayer and so on. Sometimes for the celebration of particular events, like the birth of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, or any particular event, his ascension into heaven, or Laylatul Qadr, the reception of the Quran on earth. These occasions are all celebrated in most mosques, and commemorated rather, in most mosques throughout the world, and is held within the area where the interior of the mosque or the prayer area is. So from that we can see that the area of the mosque is not always the largest part of the mosque, by the way. Sometimes you find the courtyard would be larger depending on what purpose the rest of the mosque served. Now we come to a particular part which we find in virtually every mosque. One of the most important characteristics of an established structured mosque would be that it is always, the prayer direction is oriented towards Mecca. And you find a niche, or what we call the mihrab, which shows the direction of prayer, which the prayer leader would face, and the people behind the prayer leader would face in the direction. Wherever Muslims are, of course, they face towards Mecca in prayer. And this prayer niche, or the mihrab, indicates the qibla, which is the direction of prayer. And the prayer leader stands therein praying, and people behind follow him. An intriguing feature of the mihrab and its direction, which is the qibla, is the fact that it represents somewhat a central point of the mosque. Though it's not in the center of the mosque, but it's normally in the center of the front of the mosque. And you approach the mosque coming towards it. And as you come towards it, you find it's a niche directing you towards a further direction. In that way, it's somewhat indicative that as you enter the mosque, and as you enter the prayer area, the mihrab, or the niche in the mosque, it's not the end of the journey coming to the mosque. It is a continuous journey. As you come to the mosque, the onward journey through Mecca, through prayer towards the direction to Mecca, you're thinking of the Supreme Being, the God of Abraham, of Moses, of Jesus, and of Adam, peace be upon all of them, that being praying in the mosque in that direction, though unifies believers all over the world, in that they pray in the same direction, but also it indicates that as you come to the mosque, at the wall of the mosque, the front wall of the mosque, there is a niche indicating that you've arrived here, but there is a journey to go beyond, directing you further, upward and onward. And this is very symbolic and something that we need to look at. So the mosque is not an end point in itself, but somewhat a fundamental starting point for a journey that must go beyond the here and the now. Also, very often, next to the niche, the prayer niche, or the mihrab, is the minbar. And the minbar is virtually a pulpit on which the Prophet, peace be upon him, and subsequent to that, there we see, for example, an imam leading the prayer. And on the right-hand side, we find a brown stairway virtually on which the imam or the khatib would stand on Friday or on any occasion where the speaker would get up and address the congregation. It served as an elevation from which people could see the speaker, as well as from which the voice could be heard, as well as a focal point for the congregation to look at the preacher or the speaker or the khatib or the imam or the leader addressing them. So somewhat the minbar or the pulpit also indicates somewhat a degree of authority and leadership. And this is in Islam specifically inextricably interlinked and intertwined. And that's why we find that the Friday prayer or the Friday service at noon, the Jum'ah prayer, is distinct from other prayers in that it is preceded by an obligatory sermon. And very often in mosques where they do have a minbar, the imam would ascend the pulpit. It's almost as if you are speaking from the platform of the Prophet. And it's very significant in that. Addressing the congregation from a central point in the mosque was an important function of the prophetic office, and a symbol of his leadership and authority, and somewhat, even today, a symbol of guidance and somewhat of leadership. One of the other features that we need to look at is the interior of the dome, and sometimes these are the most elaborately structured parts of the mosque. And here we have one in Jerusalem, in one of the mosques in Jerusalem, one of the most beautiful domes, the interior of the dome. And you need to understand, as we speak now about Islam, the mosque as a symbol of faith and an expression of Islamic civilization, and also here we can see the artistic dimension thereof. The art of Islam is principally a manifestation of the unity of God. The use of different media of art produces a striking visual image of the primary belief in Islam, which is that there is no God but Allah, no object worthy of worship but God. Sayyid Hussein Nasr, one of the great contemporary scholars of Islam in living in America, said, and I quote, "Islamic art is the result," oh, there we see a beautiful beautiful artwork of a dome of a contemporary mosque. He says, "Islamic art is the result of the manifestation of unity upon the plane of multiplicity. It reflects in a binding manner the unity of the divine principle, the dependence of all multiplicity upon the one, the ephemerality of the world, and the positive qualities of cosmic existence or creation about which God assists in the Quran that He has not created the world in vain. Art, therefore, is a projection of the fundamental belief in Islam. And since Islamic art is the reflection of the unity of God, its source can only be God itself. And therefore, the mosque is an artistic expression, tries to express that reality." When we look at the domes that we have seen and the interior of the domes, we find the mathematical exactness and harmony permeating the architecture of the mosque, directing attention away from the temporal, from the temporality and change. In fact, all the lines of the mosque refer to the signs of God, and the emptiness of the mosque somewhat, of the empty space, reflect the poverty of this world in the presence of the majesty of God. And therefore, the architecture of the mosque that we have seen thus far provides a glimpse of the creative genius of Islam, which produced the legacy of Islamic art in a deeply spiritual context. We have a call on the line. Please, sir, go ahead. Or lady. State your name, Jerry from Venice. Go ahead, Jerry.
Yeah, I have a question for you as to whether you see a difference between the way that mosques are used in Islam versus the way, let's say, temples in Buddhism or Hinduism or Judaism or churches, for example, in Christianity. And what I mean, for example, is that at the conclusion of prayers, let's say in the Buddhist temple, even though, say, if you're talking about Tibetan Buddhists, you know, they've 1.2 million Tibetan Buddhists have been killed by the Chinese,
right.
But we don't find Tibetan Buddhists coming out of the prayers saying, you know, death to the Chinese and you know, we've got to kill and so forth. We don't find people coming out of...
Yeah. I think we lost the caller there. I think the question that Jerry was asking was the issue about how the mosque is what I mean, the form of worship, and how is the mosque used as such, basically after prayer, what are the activities? I think he was referring to Tibetan Buddhist, 1.2 million, according to Jerry, was killed in China. You don't find them saying death to Chinese or whatever, and I didn't get the latter part. But of course, the mosque is a center of worship, and of course, there are mosques and churches and synagogues all over the world. And it depends on who is in charge of the mosque and what they allow the mosque to be used or abused, or the church to be used or abused for example. Those are particular areas or particular people that need to be questioned about that. But in general, as you can see, and you can go to any mosque, by the way, Jerry, you are welcome to go to any mosque at any time. And I've mentioned this before, please go to any mosque, and if you have any problems, let me know. You can contact us here. And go and see what happens. You're welcome to go to any mosque and have an idea of how people pray, what they do, what they say, how they interact. I think very often the idea that something strange happens in the mosque, and this is primarily one of the reasons why we are doing some programs of this nature, to bring the mosque, which 60 of them are in Southern California, and many of us may not have visited a mosque, for the matter of a synagogue or a church. And so it's very important for us to understand the other, for the other is us and we are them. So we need to understand that, and not to think of some exotic thing that's happening, that death to China or death to whatever it may be. That have we seen this happening here? Do we see it in California? If it happens somewhere in Nigeria or somewhere in Iran or somewhere in Northern Ireland, Don't juxtapose that position on every mosque everywhere else. It's a very specific question of specific things happening. The general mosque is not like that. And of course, we need to be very clear about that. The mosque is essentially a place of worship and an access for the community of believers. And of course, as you can see, a center of serenity, a center of development. And when we come back after this, we have an excellent guest, a dear friend, and we will further look at the mosque and the role of the mosque, and specifically answer the kind of question that you're asking: what has the mosque been used for throughout history, and how has it evolved today, and how is it used today as well? Thank you very much. We're coming back. I'll be back in 10 minutes. I'll be here. Make sure you are there. We're waiting for your calls. Don't go away. Welcome to Cal State University, Domingo Hills. We're coming to you live online, all over the world and locally. We are on DHTV. And this is the SBS 318 course at Cal State University, Domingo Hills, Islamic Culture and Civilization. I'm your instructor, Sadullah Khan. And I have a dear friend, Omar Izzuddin, director of the New Horizon Elementary School in Irvine. And we welcome him, Omar Izzuddin. Welcome. Peace be unto you. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Great to have you. And I've been chatting for an hour on mosques, and about time that I get all of you.
Yeah, alhamdulillah.
Enjoyed the program so far?
Very much. Thank you.
Thank you. I think one of the points that, if the question I was asking as well, and I think the issue is that people are under the impression that sometimes the mosque is primarily a place of worship, but, and that's all. I mean, there's different dimensions to a mosque. I mean, it's also a place for, besides congregational worship, it's a multi-dimensional center somewhat.
I definitely agree. I mean, I think the term of the use of the term center is very appropriate.
Yes.
Because it takes us back to the original concept of what a masjid was or what a mosque was. It wasn't a place just for worship, but it was a place for learning. It was a place for some sort of sporting activity, a place to come together and discuss issues, mm-hmm. Even just a place to meet, for people to meet and to strengthen ties of brotherhood and sisterhood. Very common knowledge was that the masjid wasn't just a place to go to pray. And I think appropriately so, you find less and less things being called the masjid of Culver City or the mosque so-and-so. More and more the term Islamic center is being used because of that concept, that it's more than just a place of worship.
I almost the impression that we are going back to the original. I think that maybe in the initial part it was a comprehensive center.
Definitely.
And then it became more a kind of a place of worship, you know, maybe in the last two centuries or so somewhat. And now we're going back to the original mosque, the idea of it being a comprehensive center somewhat. Do you think that's happening? Maybe you find that's what's happening?
Yeah, definitely. I know definitely if you look at the history, or at least the most the recent history of Muslim immigrants, of course, we're not talking about the numerous Muslims that were always in America. However, if you look at the current history, the modern history of immigrants to the United States, you find that most of what the mosque was for was almost kind of a sense of homesickness being cured.
Yes.
Because it was just, you know, it was that place to go and pray, to take care of that particular
yes.
matter. But to really become a center for development, mm-hmm. it didn't really start to take that form until, I would say, very recently, within the last 20, 30 years.
Yeah. I think, you see people praying in China, for example, right? The picture, you have a beautiful picture of
yeah.
mosque in China where people are praying. So, I mean, of course, it's still the primarily a center of worship as such. The word masjid implies that. But attached to that center of worship are the various important activities that enhances the social dimension of the center itself. And that's why the idea of the Markaz Islami or the Islamic center itself is becoming more in vogue. In fact, most centers here or places of worship in America are actually called centers. Very few of them are really called mosques. It's very true what you're saying.
Definitely. And I think it's also important not to lose sight of the fact that in its core, in its origin, it is a place of worship, especially if you look at all of the other activities that occur in an Islamic center or in a masjid are in some way or shape a form of worship.
Oh, yes. That's
so, you know, for example, seeking knowledge is a form of worship. And so in a sense, although you may be seeking knowledge in a masjid, you are still in a way worshipping God.
This is very, the whole idea of ibadah, the idea of, you know, everything good that you do or with directed with sincere intention, with God consciousness, is considered what you call an ibadah.
Exactly.
In Islam. A few weeks ago we did a program on terms and terminology. We dealt with the concept of ibadah, which you so beautifully expressed now, the idea that even learning, maybe helping someone, you know, advising someone, all this is part of a general worship.
Of course.
Even a ritual worship. So you would then say then, for example, that the mosque in itself is for all forms of worship, but somewhat the ritual worship, which is a salah, for want of a better word, it also entails other dimensions of worship.
Absolutely. I mean, I think you had given the example of how masjid became the storehouse for goods, for the needy, including food, including money, including clothing. So in a sense, to bring clothing or to bring those things as a form of charity to a masjid, you're in fact, you
yes.
know, that's one form of ibadah.
Ibadah of worship.
And once again, a form of worship that's an obligation upon all Muslims.
But didn't that also cut down this dichotomy? Of you know the mosque, not I mean didn't sort of break down the barrier, you know, that very often places of worship only for prayer, and you know you go back by having those kind of social activities and looking out, it really became the access of the community. I mean,
absolutely,
the means of this.
It definitely. I mean, to kind of address an issue brought up by another caller, although the masjid will have its largest congregation on Fridays, the purpose of it really should be more of an ongoing thing. There should be nightly activities that occur at the masjid, whether they be classes or youth groups or even homeless feedings of that sort. It's really seen as a center for those types of activities.
Yeah, I think, and there you see a group of people discussing in one of the mosques, I think, in Palestine or in Syria. I think that's Palestine. So you find that it's also a center for discussion, for congregational worship, in fact, and also sometimes for celebration or commemoration of large events, for example, not necessarily worship. The ritual worship may be part of the large, like in Ramadan, for example, though we have the prayer, but also the reading of the Quran, the breaking of fast,
sure.
People come together and so on, besides the prayer and the discussion. You also have, you know, large, sometimes you have thousands of people coming together to, for example, commemorate a particular event.
One of the first ones that comes to mind is a wedding.
Yes.
Very often weddings are conducted right there in the masjid, sometimes in the place of prayer, in fact.
Yes.
And like you had mentioned, hundreds, thousands of people would have come to attend such an occasion.
Okay. So yeah, it depends on the... So it generally, it's primarily, I mean, an access of the community and somewhat a focal point for the community. I mean, from what we have discussed earlier on the previous hour, the mosque is virtually seen as a symbol, an expression of an Islamic presence. And here, for example, we see hundreds of thousands of people at the mosque in Pakistan coming together. This is called a commemoration of, I think, Maulid al-Nabawi, a celebration of the birth of the Prophet. But any other event, maybe it could have been Laylul Qadr, the night of the reception of the Quran. Here we can see, I mean, you know, thousands of people gathering together. So it's not only in worship, but it has throughout history been like that. And I think even now with the greater awareness that people have generally regarding religion in this country and so on, you find that increasingly there's more focus on the mosque and the Islamic center is becoming more a center for interaction.
Absolutely. That's very much a critical aspect of the masjid, is it's a place for people to come together and, like you say, interact.
Yes, the whole idea of jama'ah.
Exactly.
Congregation. We have a short video of showing, indicating the a brief history of the mosques. And so let's have a look at the video.
Work of art is the Dome of the Rock. It was built in a city that was holy to Christians and Jews, and it's spectacular.
Like Mecca and the Kaaba, the significance of this holy site goes back to Abraham, for the rock within is said to be the place he nearly sacrificed his son. It was built to rival the nearby Church of the Holy Sepulchre, where Jesus was said to have been buried.
What's extraordinary about the Dome of the Rock is how perfect it is. People revered this site as some place that was holy to Abraham and to Isaac. Imagine, if you will, these new guys coming in and taking over this piece of prime real estate and building a new building for a new religion that sits on top of a mountain and sparkles and glitters in the sunlight for everyone to see. This is not something that a fly by night. This is something big and important. Islam has come to stay.
In just 100 years, Muhammad's vision had transformed the spiritual and political map of the world. And his followers had established an empire larger than Rome. But Muhammad never lived to see it. The lessons of the Quran, so successful for the Muslims in Medina and Mecca, were playing out on a global scale. As the conquest swept through Syria, the Muslims held their Friday prayers in the Church of St. John the Baptist in Damascus, allowing its Christian congregation to continue their services on Sunday. Side by side, the two faiths shared the same building, in peace. As the Muslim community grew, they bought the old church from the Christian congregation and built a huge mosque on the site. With Byzantine artisans, they decorated it with golden mosaics of an Islamic paradise. The Great Mosque of Damascus would become a model for new mosques to come, all across the empire. The palaces of ancient Baghdad have been lost over the centuries, but in its glory, it rivaled ancient Athens or Rome. It was a magnificent architectural achievement, the pride of Islam in a new age. One visitor left this account. All the exquisite neighborhoods covered with parks, gardens, villas, and beautiful promenades are filled with bazaars and finely built mosques and baths. They stretch for miles on both sides of the glittering river. But what made this the greatest city of its time was more than just what met the eye. It was the company it kept. Scholars made Baghdad the jewel of the world.
Certainly from the 8th century on, Baghdad was the center of learning in the Islamic world, and all major innovations either came from Baghdad or quickly came to Baghdad because the best people came to Baghdad, the best thinkers, the best philosophers, the best artists.
They came in search of answers to pragmatic questions. The empire's meteoric growth had left its new leaders overwhelmed. They had staggering engineering and logistical problems to contend with. Solving them would take the greatest minds of the day.
Under the new empire now, you are responsible for public hygiene, you are responsible for the marketplace, you are responsible for goods being sold in the marketplace. All of those require some basic elementary sciences. This new civilization, having a need for science, really stems from the need to run that empire.
The best minds rose to the call. The finest were welcomed at a center of scholarship, Baghdad's renowned House of Wisdom.
It was a magnet for scholars and intellectuals who came and worked in the academies. There were public libraries associated with the palace, and scholars came from all over the empire. And there were scholars from Iran, there were scholars from Byzantium who came. Some were Christians, some were Muslims, some were Jews. And all of these different sort of threads of human knowledge came together in the city of Baghdad.
So the net effect of this is that you've got human individuals from radically different cultural traditions being thrown into the same crucible.
The challenge that greeted these scholars was daunting. The great works of the ancients had to be transformed into a wholly new body of knowledge.
Allahu Akbar! Allahu Akbar! Ashhadu an la...
Mosques were now on every horizon. They welcomed traders. They housed schools and hospitals. Through Islamic architecture, literature, and music, a vibrant culture was emerging in celebration of a singular faith.
وما أدراك ما ليلة القدر.
Welcome back to the Social Behavioral Science 318 course. I'm your instructor, Sadullah Khan, and we have with us Omar Izzuddin, who is the director of the New Horizon Elementary School in Irvine. And we have just seen a snippet from the an extract from Islam, the Empire of Faith, and referring to the development of the mosque through history, through the early history in the early period of Islam. And we realize that during the peak of Islamic civilization, the masjid was an institution of learning that produced scholars and scientists. And of course, it enriched the Islamic culture in itself and where the Islamic culture was manifest. And also, as we will do in subsequent programs, deal with the whole issue of the impact of Islamic civilization on the Renaissance and of course the modern times as well and the postmodern era. Now, one of the things that we see from the outset, and we have discussed it somewhat, but early on, is that though it is seen as a religious building, the whole idea of what is religious is not only to do with worship. This idea of a comprehensiveness of faith. Could you perhaps elaborate upon that aspect?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is, the traditions of the Prophet, peace be upon him, insisting on the seeking of knowledge, mm-hmm. and how that in itself becomes, that in itself becomes an act of worship. Mm-hmm. Other things including, strengthening of the body, staying healthy, mm-hmm. and how those were activities that were participated in the masjid. Mm-hmm. Once again, broadening the definition of really what worship means.
Yes.
So those are the first impressions I get when I see that, the masjid isn't limited to just, prayer or that isolated yes. form of worship that most people tend to associate with the masjid. Yes.
And also the whole idea of comprehensiveness, it's looking at the holistic development, that not only to be spiritually developed, it also requires, you mentioned now, the various traditions of the Prophet, dealing with the intellectual development, the moral development, it's in isolation, the physical development, these are all intertwined of the holistic development of a person rather than a particular field. You cannot just be a good person in prayer, but you need to be good even in your attitude, your behavior, at the same time physically, mentally, pure. You can't drink, you should never be mentally, at a disadvantage, not to be fully focused. So these are some of the things that I think you mentioned. Now, one of the things that we look at is the point you mentioned about as you emphasized on 2-3 occasions thus far, the issue of learning. Did the early mosque, play that role of providing that? I mean, was it a place that people just came to learn, or how did the learning take place? I mean, how did the mosque offer that opportunity to them?
Well, you look at, the first thing that the Prophet, peace be upon him, did when he came to Medina after the migration from Mecca was to build a masjid. Mm-hmm. And that masjid was to be not only a place of worship, but it was to be a place of learning. Mm-hmm. And at the moment, the most pressing need was, of course, several new Muslims and Muslims, entering into Islam by the thousands. Mm-hmm. Was this need to teach the people the religion, the basics. It's something as simple as how to pray or how to wash before the prayer. Here we have courses upon courses and people can get a master's degree in Islamic studies, mm-hmm. but still not have even have the knowledge necessary to understand how to be a Muslim. Mm-hmm. And so there's the basics, which could be taught very simply. But then more and more questions would develop, and the general needs that life would put upon the new Muslim mm-hmm. would always open up the doors to new information. And the masjid became the location at which they could ask the Prophet, peace be upon him, mm-hmm. or other learned people,
yes.
To learn those basics of how to be a Muslim.
But at the same time, I think that imbued in them a spirit of looking at the world, the whole idea, I think, also of this first revelation the Prophet Muhammad received was Iqra, read. In other words, look at the world, Bismi Rabbik, you know, the idea with a God-oriented vision. In other words, do you see the majesty of God reflected in everything that is there? So, though it was learning the fundamentals of faith and so on and so forth, but it also was a whole new vision of how to look at the world, mm-hmm. because it gave impetus to the study of every field, virtually. So, I mean, and that is why the same people who learned basically the initial part of the basics of the faith, who then would use their own expertise as well as their own in whatever field of science or learning they were in, and look at it from an Islamic perspective, from the information they received, and perhaps build further into their field.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, it wasn't limited to just religious teachings. I mean, obviously, they would come there, as it was mentioned in that clip that you just showed. Mm-hmm. People would come to the masjid to learn more than just religious learnings. They would come to talk about philosophy. They'd come to learn about astronomy. Mm-hmm. Things that would you know, be considered, you know, secular or non-religious teachings.
Yeah, this is the question. So there wasn't a dichotomy between the religious and secular in a distinct sense?
You know, there may be a separation, technically wise, just as much as you could separate math from science.
Yes.
But in the end, it's all knowledge.
Yes.
And if you can look at the masjid as a storehouse of knowledge, mm-hmm. which included Islamic education as well as education about science or education about the arts, mm-hmm. and you see how seeking that knowledge, as you so accurately indicated, in the name of your Lord. Mm-hmm. You know, it really all kind of comes together again.
Yes.
That even though you may be studying art, mm-hmm. to do it in the name of your Lord, or to do it in the name of God,
yes.
you've essentially brought it back to the same category of seeking knowledge being an act of worship, regardless of whether it be knowledge in terms of religious knowledge, or whether it become knowledge in terms of helping the world be a better place. The numerous discoveries that were made by Muslims are a clear indication of that.
Also, the whole idea of course, the idea of the secular and the religious. I think the whole idea that the whole world, whatever we do, if we do it with the God orientation and idea of it being worshipped in some way. But the other point is mentioned also in the clip, and we looked at the mosque in Kawa Vasadi as well. This whole idea that the very fact that most often the largest libraries were attached to mosques.
Absolutely.
Yeah. What does that indicate, perhaps?
I mean, like I had mentioned, it's the storehouse of knowledge. This is where...
The physical sense, too.
Absolutely. I mean, this is where, you know, you could come here to meet other people who were also studying a particular subject, mm-hmm. and you could essentially share the knowledge that was gained. Mm-hmm. Where better a place than a place that receives more and more traffic, yes. i.e. a masjid.
Yes. For example, even in Egypt, for example, Al-Azhar, for example, you find that there are still ancient manuscripts. It's still a reservoir for the ancient manuscripts, and of course still a center of learning after 1,000 years. It's essentially a mosque, but it is, of course, has many branches right now. But the point I'm making is that the fact that it was a reservoir for the learned people and a reservoir for books, it made it somewhat a conducive environment for learning in itself in general, and thus for the enhancement of further learning, and for the open the pathway for further learning as well.
Absolutely.
The other point is that we look at the mosque. Perhaps the emphasis of the communal reference, the idea of building community of what they call the ummah. How would you perhaps view that? The idea of it being center for that.
Yeah, I remember once listening to somebody in a masjid who was saying that as Muslims come together more and more, and you perceive this idea of, you know, 5 daily prayers, mm-hmm. and maybe they won't come to all 5 of the daily prayers, but there is that constant connection, mm-hmm. in the hearts and minds of Muslims, mm-hmm. and although that physical connection may only come once a week, mm-hmm. Through the Jummah prayer, the mm-hmm. congregation that you described, there is still that hub, mm-hmm. that it serves.
Okay.
you know, for lack of a better term, it's the local hangout, so to speak. Right. It's the one place that you know there will always be somebody there five times a day.
Yeah.
You can almost count on that.
Yes.
And so, for, you know, when you talk about community, there has to be that feeling of dependability.
Yes.
And interestingly enough, and you would probably be a better person to describe this, is the use of the word ummah, which has the same root as umm, meaning mother.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that same thing, like that dependability that we've come to count on with our mothers, especially as infants.
Yes.
You see that as an ummah or as a community, you can come to depend on your community. And there needs to be some sort of establishment that creates that feeling.
Yes.
Like, why do I know I can count on my brothers and sisters being at the masjid?
Mm-hmm.
Because I know that there are five daily prayers that are on a particular time.
Yes.
It's almost like there's a standing invitation for anybody and everyone to come to see someone in their community. If they have a concern, they could address it at the congregation that happens to be there.
Yes.
Very often in most masjids, you'll always find some sort of a message board, some sort of an announcement board, help wanted, help needed, help offered kind of a...
Yes. So in other words, it serves as a communal, as you said, a hub, you know, and also as an avenue whereby, besides coming together, is truly a reflection of the community spirit and the community's well-being. It's almost a sense of a continuous community. I mean, it's not like a once-a-week thing, for example,
exactly.
You know, because then it's there, they may not be there, but there are five times, and everyone knows, if I know there's a mosque in the area, and I know it's Maghrib prayer at particular times. I don't have to even have a watch. I know it's sunset prayers and more, or noon prayers around noon, this afternoon. I go to the mosque where it is, and it'll be, I don't have to ask, is the service at 3 o'clock or 7 o'clock or 9 o'clock? So there's a sense of continuous community. That also helps, doesn't it? I mean,
absolutely. I mean, you picture things of that are generally considered community centers,
mm-hmm.
like, for example, you know, a YMCA,
mm-hmm.
right? You have to wonder, what are the office hours? What are the available things?
For example.
You know the office hours of every masjid.
Yes.
And similarly, another thing I was thinking about is a lot of us tend to live in communities that have quote-unquote community centers.
Mm-hmm.
But these centers are used primarily for isolated events.
Right.
And sometimes very infrequent.
Right.
No dependability,
yes.
no sense of you know when the events are going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And even more so, those events are generally closed off, isolated to a particular group in the community.
I see.
As opposed to the masjid.
Mm-hmm.
There's never a time where this particular dhuhr prayer is only going to be for a particular group of the community.
Yes.
It's all inclusive.
Right.
Which is really, when you want to use the word community, you have to be able to accept all.
Yes.
And you see there's absolutely no discrimination. Young, old, sick, you know, healthy, strong, weak. It's all, they all come, and women.
That brings me to the next point I'd like to look at, the whole idea of, you know, educating the community somewhat. If you look at, educating the individual, you know, scholars and so on is one thing. I mean, maybe the new Muslim or whatever. That's at a very basic level, you know, in the early history of Islam and so on. But when you look at, for example, sometimes the community needed to be you know, informed about how to behave, how to interact. Because don't forget, when you have a new kind of ethos, you have to, very often people even today in modern contemporary society, for example, you find that classes on marriage, for example, how to deal with one another, you know, how to deal
parenting
with...
Parenting classes.
Yes, parenting classes, for example, you know. And in fact, and in South Africa, we have what they call marriage classes. People go to marriage classes. And sometimes you go to meet spouses there, but that's something else. But what I mean is, it's the idea is to learn, you know, some of the things that you take for granted, that when you are thrown into that. So I think also the idea of, you know, somewhat educating the community, I don't mean educating now to do with how
academic,
to pray and so on.
Yeah.
I'm talking about even educating the community. Very often you'd find that's why the mosque used to be a place also, I think, for resolving conflict, and not only resolving the conflict, but how to, you know, very often you find that happening. And once again, we find the mosque increasingly, specifically in America, becoming that way, you know, solving issues and so on. You know, you can comment on that perhaps.
Or even addressing issues, you know, current events.
Mm.
You know, the masjid generally became a place where current events were discussed.
Mm-hmm.
Where else would that be done in such a group?
Mm-hmm.
At the very least, generally the Jummah addresses, the Jummah, which is the khutbah or the sermon.
On Friday.
Mm-hmm. It generally addresses a current issue that's happening among the ummah. Where the khatib or the leader,
it must be something relevant. It can't be just something.
Exactly. It's almost always something relevant. So on the very basic, at very least, every community member who fulfills the obligation of the congregational prayer once a week will be in some way educated.
Mm-hmm.
And when we talk about this type of education, it's not the type of education that's associated with a degree or that's associated with being, you know, some kind of a scholar in religious knowledge. No, just the
to
general...
Be informed.
To be informed, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And And where else would it be done otherwise?
Yeah.
You know, when in an age where you can't rely on the printed media, or there's so much printed media to try to finally get a well-rounded view, mm-hmm. you really get to see this this focused perspective
yes.
of how the current issues in the world affect the Muslims, or even affect the local community.
Yes, and I think also the idea is that what kind of direction, because people know something's happening, for example. You know, what do you do? How do you go about handling the issue? So you find that, you know, that you... Please, people, please call us in at 1-800-339-1193. You're welcome to any suggestions, any questions you have or comments. Please feel free to call in. I think is the idea that it also focuses the people. You know, people may come. Sometimes you may not know of some news that may have happened, or something happened in some part of the world, maybe earthquake or a disaster somewhere, or yeah. something may have happened. And not only are you aware of it right now, because you may hear through the news, if you listen to watch the news, or depending which news you listen to, what perspective you get. But here also there is a direction, almost the khatib or the preacher or the one who gives a sermon will sort of how do we deal with this issue? There may be an earthquake, for
Absolutely.
Example, in Los Angeles. What can we do? You go to the mosque or the church or synagogue, but also a directive as to, you know, what needs to be done from a spiritual and a religious perspective. So people immediately are informed in that way. So it serves as an education in that way as well. The other thing that I maybe need to look at is the issue the issue of how the mosque in the early history also was used as a place of preparation for people. Sometimes you'd find that the commander of the armed forces would come there, they would be advised as to what they would do and how to go about things. So, and also even judge matters. Sometimes there was a judging of matters where people may have had a dispute. So maybe you could comment on some of that in the early history of Islam, and maybe how this somewhat coming back to that again today.
Well, you know, the fundamental level is, you give the example of marriage counseling or marriage courses. Mm. That's a very good example of judging between different parties. Mm. And then, of course, from there, it can transcend all the way up to major business issues between two differing sides. Mm. The masjid always appeared to have that sense of neutrality.
Right.
And that was something that whenever you look throughout history, mm-hmm. With some exceptions, you always could count on the masjid to be that location
yes.
that was always neutral.
Okay.
It was never on the side of one particular person over another.
Yes.
And that's indicative by the fact that, you know, you should rarely find, and in fact it's something that you shouldn't find in Islam, a masjid named after a person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you wouldn't have Masjid Omar Ez-Zeddin.
Mm, yes.
Hopefully
not.
Hopefully not. Because, in, especially if I'm still alive in the community,
yes.
there is already that perceived bias.
Mm, yes.
So you always have that the masjids are named after Allah, or they're named Masjid al-Islam, or
yes,
some name that indicates neutrality.
Neutrality, yes.
No,
there are some mosques named after people, of course. They are there, obviously.
Sure.
I mean, ideally, it shouldn't be that way.
Of course.
One of the other things is, I was talking about the idea of judging between people, like you said, but it was also sometimes a place where people physically train. There's evidence in the prophetic tradition that people used to train. And I know physically train, and sometimes there was one indication that the Ethiopians were doing some kind of a sword practicing, you know, and so on, in demonstration in the courtyard of the mosque, the Sahan area. Now, also you find in America increasingly this call and this idea that, you know, we should have a center which is comprehensive, not only meeting the educational needs and the spiritual needs, as you're saying, and the idea of the social needs where we have discussions and classes, but also somewhat sporting facilities, for example. And I think that's what people are looking at. I mean, in the urban area, there's a whole idea of looking at, and in many parts of the world, I think in South Africa, for example, looking at getting ground next to the mosque or in the region where you can look at the recreational facilities. Now, that's something that I think needs to be increasingly looked at, maybe. That's something which is lacking, perhaps, in some of the centers.
I think definitely a lot more of the newer masjids that are being built, you'll always find a basketball court somewhere in the parking
yes.
lot.
Mm-hmm.
And almost always after some sort of a function, rarely on Jummah just because of it being a work day,
mm-hmm.
but mostly on Sundays or any days where there's classes,
yeah.
it'll always be followed by children playing basketball or playing some sort of a sport. I know this is very common, especially in the area that I'm from. Always, it's kind of a routine for us, is that after Sunday classes, they'll go across the street and we'll play some sort of a sport at the local park.
Right.
It's a very common thing, and I think it's becoming much more popular now than it has been in the past.
Yes.
The focus is that, you know, the playtime, if you will, or the sporting time is just as important as the
right.
study time or the learning time.
Yeah. Also, the other thing is a place for consultation. Now, this is not beyond the idea of judging between people. And this is something which has been continuously part of the mosque. I think maybe this idea of a recreational facility and so on may not always be the case. Like, you know, in some areas, the mosque may be in the downtown area, for example, or in a very confined space, so you don't even have sufficient space for classrooms, maybe, you know, just basically managing to have the basics of the mosque. And by the same time, you'll find that, you know, this whole idea of it being a center for consultation on issues. Like, for example, you'd find after the September 11th tragedy, you'd find that, you know, increasingly the Muslims would come together, not only to pray and so on, like all other people of faith came and prayed, and there was a great spirit of cooperation and understanding, but at the same time, to consult with one another. And I see it's, even in the last 3 or 4 years that I've been in America, I see it in America in particular, increasingly becoming a center where people are consulting with one another, even contending the issues and contending views are brought forth, and people, it's becoming much more that. It's always been like that, but more so. And this is great, don't you think?
Absolutely. I think it's wonderful. I mean, it goes beyond just, you know, going to the sheikh or the resident scholar at a masjid and asking his particular legal opinion on on whatever issue may be troubling the person. Yes. But there's even that sense of it comes back to community and counting on one another, and that I could, you know, I could count on brother so and so who's an expert in legal terms.
Right.
And I can get some sort of consultation from him. And sometimes you'll find even a lot of centers or masjids have programs specialized, you know, come get legal advice on this day, come get medical advice on this day, etc.
Yes.
And
yes.
They become very organized with that type of consulting.
Yes.
And of course, along with that is religious consulting, advice on what would be best for me.
You brought a point that I think that I need to get into my mind. One of the things you don't find right now attached to the mosque or linked to the mosque is in the early times, Islamic period, of course, being a comprehensive center, and of course a larger space, I suppose, the whole idea of housing the orphans, the needy, that is still somewhat. I know in South Africa there are mosques, what they call, they have the Darul Yatama or place for people who are traveling, you know, for the musafir. They have what they call musafir khanas in some of the mosques in South Africa, where there are lodgings attached to the mosque, directly to the mosques, that people who are traveling could spend 2 or 3 days at the expense of the mosque as a guest of the mosque or so. Or even, of course, in some cases, treating the wounded. Now, that would require a much more elaborate facility with nursing care and so on, which you don't really have right now. But the idea of caring for orphans, though Islam never encouraged the idea of orphanages, because you're supposed to take in orphans in your home. You're not supposed to have a place where you leave the orphans, rather take them into your own homes. But caring for the elderly and so on, do you find that in recent times that there is a, despite the limitation of space and even of finance sometimes, that people are looking increasingly at this kind of thing, that, you know, this idea of caring for the less privileged and for the downtrodden. I don't only mean giving food and helping. I do know mosques have become centers where people are raising funds to help people. But do you think that maybe have become a part of the a component of the of a contemporary mosque here?
It's an interesting phenomenon, and I think it may have something to do with the fact that we're so spread out here on the West Coast.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of an orphanage being attached to a masjid, or the idea of a school being attached to a masjid, and the whole idea of attachment has suddenly gotten a slightly broader gap. And I'll give you a good example. For example, we've got the Ummah Free Clinic. This is a free clinic in South Central Los Angeles that serves the needs of sick, injured people who need medical attention
across the board,
non-Muslim and Muslim as well. And so, you know, would we call the Ummah Free Clinic a masjid? I mean, I would call it a free clinic. Would I call it attached to a masjid? I think so. Is there one masjid that's necessarily associated with it? No, which is actually the beauty of it.
Yes.
It's kind of like the clinic that every masjid loves to attach itself to.
And
likewise with the schools.
Essential service,
yeah, and the schools are another great example. For example, the school I'm the director at, New Horizons, is the fourth New Horizons school.
Mm-hmm.
The first one is in fact attached to the Islamic Center of Southern California. The other three being attached, but not geographically. They have their own locations. One's in Pasadena, one's in West Los Angeles. The one I'm at is in Irvine, and of course the one that's attached to the Islamic Center is in downtown Los Angeles. So I think the term attachment is still there.
Mm-hmm.
Everything is in some way or form attached to a place of worship, or to a masjid, but it's no longer the physical attachment in terms of geographically, because of the way we are and our mobility and our ability to move and telecommunications and things of that sort, we can have that attachment, but it doesn't have to be
physically
attached to it.
Yeah. Another important point, I think, is the idea that the mosque is continuously being used. And in the next hour, by the way, we'll be dealing with the whole issue of the New Horizon School, as well as how the schools are developing in America as attached to centers and, directly or indirectly. And we'll focus on that. As we know, Brother Omar Izzeddin is the director of the New Horizon Elementary School in Irvine. But one of the things that I think that the mosque is continuously being also a center of learning, as you mentioned, in some cases, but even for consultation and for counseling and so on, but also for collection and distribution of charity. That is one of the major functions that you find, I think, even in America, that you find mosques, institution raising funds for the poor, for the needy. Mm. I mean, there's a program recently for the orphans worldwide and so on. So you find that this is has been almost an integral component of the mosque program. Mm. That it's all an essential part of the mosque. You know, they raise funds, irrespective of where the mosque is located. Even in poor areas, you find, though they may be in need of funds in their own area, and they do raise funds. But you find that whenever there's a disaster somewhere in the world or something, that mosques always rally. As a center which provides, for example, this collection of charity and distribution of charity. Could you perhaps elaborate on that, perhaps?
I mean, this could be another one. I really feel like we've developed this concept of charity or collecting charity into a very organized system. We have lots of organizations, just to name one, Islamic Relief, which, although it may not be attached to a masjid, I think it's doing something, and organizations just like it are creating a more organized system of collecting these funds. One thing that you can't go into a masjid or a mosque of any kind and not find is a donation box.
Yes.
Or a box for zakat.
Which is the
obligatory charity that Muslims have to pay. So this is really indicative of what you're talking about. There, that box is there. Mm-hmm. The need or that reminder that the masjid, one of the core purposes, I mean, it's almost like the mihrab you had described before.
Yes.
Where's the mihrab? Where's the box for charity?
Yes.
You can't, a masjid without one, there's something missing.
Yes.
Because it's like you come into the masjid, the first thing, or usually it's one of the first things by the door, one of the first things that comes to mind is, where's my charity go? Because that reminder that coming to the masjid is a charitable act. And then, of course, the constant reminders to give charity, let alone not to mention, of course, the obligatory aspect, which is called the zakat.
Of course, not only charity, which is obligatory. There's obligatory tax which you give the zakat, the 2.5% which you give of whatever you have beyond your basic means which you earn.
Yeah.
But this is ongoing charity which you give at any time and so on and so forth.
Or there's even zakatul fitr.
Yes, or for
and where is that collected?
For example,
I don't know anybody that doesn't give their zakat al fitr at the masjid.
Yes,
exactly.
So we come to the end of the second hour. We have looked at the mosque in the first hour and the structure of the mosque and some of the symbolism attached to those structures and what it means and so on. And we've looked at various mosques throughout the world, from the heart of Africa to the deserts of the Middle East to the jungles of Malaysia. And we have seen some of the mosques and its structures and what it signifies, what it implies. In this hour, we have looked and discussed the role of the mosque historically and also in contemporary society. What does the mosque mean? What role does it play in contemporary Muslim society, specifically in America? Looking at the original mosque, the prototype, which was the Mosque of the Prophet in Medina, and how it has developed and how it is still in use as a place of worship primarily, but also beyond that, looking at the various social and economic and intellectual and spiritual needs of the community. When we come back after this, we will be dealing with how the centers of learning, basic learning, by the way, in America, here in Los Angeles, for example, attached to centers, Islamic centers and to mosques, and how they are developing. And an example of that, of the New Horizon School, and we have one of the directors, which is Omar Izzeddin, with us here. And we'll speak about that in the next hour. Don't go away. I'll be here. Hope to see you there, too. I'll be back in a few minutes. Welcome back to Cal State University, Domingo Hills.
You are live on internet worldwide and locally on TV. This is the SBS 318 course at the Islamic at the Calcutta University, Domingo Hills, on Islamic culture and civilization. I'm your instructor for the SBS 318 course. My name is Sadullah Khan. You should know by now we had 6 programs already. But nonetheless, maybe my glasses, my new one, may be fooling you slightly, but I'm the same guy behind the glasses. We've been dealing in the past 2 hours with the mosque and the structure of the mosque, and also the role of the mosque throughout history and even up to contemporary times. And we also focused somewhat in the previous hour with our guest about the mosque, one of the primary functions of the mosque as a center of learning. And of course, in the early history of Islam, education consisted of, you know, study circles or halaqas or majlis, of circles of people. And these groups were usually led by a sheikh or a hakim or a ustaz, an individual who was probably the counterpart of the modern day professor. And in these circles, discussions were conducted about some of the sciences, religious sciences for want of a better word, but also on philosophy, theology and other aspects of various different sciences, mathematics and so on. About 200 or 300 years after the passing on of the Prophet, we find that the spreading of Islam, specifically into the northern part of Africa and other parts of the world, we find that towards the beginning of the 5th century after the Prophet, in about the year 1000 after Christ, the Fatimid Khalif al-Hakim built what they call the Darul Ilm, or the House of Knowledge, in Cairo. And it possessed over 1,000 books in his library, manuscripts written by hand, and it became a model for all later Islamic centers of higher education. Similarly, in Baghdad, as we have seen in the snippet in the previous hour from the Islam, the Empire of Faith, the PBS production, about the Baghdad being a center of learning, Baghdad in modern-day Iraq, where Nizamul Mulk Tusi established a multi-college system similar to the present-day California State University system, and it was known as Madaris, and or the centers of learning. The word madrasa means a place of study, basically. Now, the madrasa, or the center of learning, eventually became a fixed component, a fixture of the Islamic center of worship, which was the mosque. And therefore, not only was learning taking place at an informal level, but even somewhat in a formal level. And thus we find these institutions, or the kulliyas, or the jami'as, attached to the mosques and all over the world, very early in the history of Islam, as far flung as Jerusalem, North Africa, Central Asia, and of course Spain. So we find one of the earliest centers of learning is that of the Al-Azhar. It's a momentous mosque whose foundation was laid in approximately 969 of the Christian era. And with the passage of ages, the Al-Azhar Mosque earned a great reputation. And besides being a mosque, it also became a university for studies of various sciences. The word Al-Azhar, of course, and there we have a picture of the Al-Azhar mosque, which is also a university. The word means the most flourished, or the shining, or the flowery, and it's named after the daughter of the Prophet, Sayyidah Fatima al-Zahra, the daughter of the Prophet, peace be upon him. And the first academic lecture given there was in October of 975 of the Christian era by Chief Justice Abul Hasan Ali ibn al-Nu'man, and starting teaching the book on jurisprudence called Al-Ikhtisar. Al-Azhar became afterwards the principal seat for Islamic learning, attended by students from all over the world. It's still the center of learning, and still we have students attending it from all over the world. So that mosque, which had an attached center of learning in an organized manner, is still an institution of learning as well as a mosque. And it's worth mentioning that all the theoretical sciences were taught at Al-Azhar in the days gone by, as it is today. And the Muslims who attended, and also non-Muslims, there were Jewish scholars, Christian scholars, male and female, attended the tuition circles that were held at the mosque. Another significant place in Africa as well, which became a great center of learning, was the Sankore Mosque in Mali, in Timbuktu. Now, very often Timbuktu is seen as a far-flung place, used in jokes, going to Timbuktu. But Timbuktu really was a center of higher learning, and the Sankore Mosque was the best bastion of learning in this west part of Africa. Its imams, or prayer leaders and scholars, were regarded with unequaled respect. Its school attracted the noble, the rich, as well as the orphans and the poor from all over the world. Indeed, mentors and scholars alike are said to have flocked to Sankore Jam'iyya, or the university, or the mosque of Sankore. And they came from all over the world. Here, surrounded by the Sahara's windswept dunes, the desert, students could concentrate their minds on nothing else but the nature around themselves and the mosque. And as you could see, the mosque itself is almost a reflection of the natural surrounding that is there. And Timbuktu's fame grew in the Islamic world and as a center of civilization, primarily because of the Sankore Mosque being a center of learning. And of course, there are several other centers that are older than many universities in England and France. For example, the Karawan University in Fez in Morocco is older than Oxford for the matter, and still being used. So centers of higher learning, such as the Al-Azhar, as the one in Karawan in Morocco, and in Timbuktu, some of them are 1,000 years old and still being used as centers of learning. Now, we have with us Brother Omar Izzuddin. Welcome once again. I wasn't going to take the whole hour, I was just going to introduce the idea of learning. I think one of the points that you emphasized on in the previous hour, when you had your say, I had some say right now, so we're going to have more says, and the idea was about the idea of the mosque being giving impetus to learning and to other social aspects, intellectual, spiritual, and social aspects of the community. And Omar Izzuddin, of course, as you know, I've introduced him as one of the directors and co-principal of the New Horizon Elementary School in Irvine, and has always been involved, even in his UCLA days, with Islamic learning, Islamic teaching, and so on and so forth, and a rising leader in the Muslim community. He's attached to the New Horizon School, which I have mentioned, in Irvine, and we are going to have a look at a brief snippet of what is happening at the school. This is now a Islamic school in Southern California, a contemporary school, the latest one.
It's opening in the fall of 2001. Located at 1 Truman Street, near the intersection of Jeffrey and Roosevelt, just half mile north of the 5 freeway, the New Horizon Elementary School of Irvine is convenient for families living all over Orange County. The school is open to students from preschool through 6th grade and can accommodate a maximum of 180 students. New Horizon chose Irvine, a city known for its multiculturalism, top-ranking schools, and safe environment, as the perfect place for its brand new campus.
I just think God probably shut the door. It's your first hope and opportunity because he opened a new door, which is in Irvine, because this is really where he wanted to plant your community. And so when things are negative, we have to trust God that he has a plan, that there's always something better down the road.
New Horizon may be new to Orange County, but its rich tradition of excellence precedes it. New Horizons Pasadena campus is the only Islamic school in the entire state of California to be accredited by the Western Association of Schools and Colleges and the California Association of Independent Schools, two of the most recognized accrediting bodies in the nation.
New Horizons Irvine campus will be one of only 6 independent schools in Orange County to be accredited by both organizations.
We want New Horizons to be a place where we're creating the leaders of the future. To do that requires rigorous academic curriculum, and my promise to you is that that's what each and every student who attends New Horizons will submit themselves to.
New Horizon Elementary School of Irvine continues the mission inherent to all New Horizon schools, a commitment to providing students with an excellent academic education and a firm grounding in moral and ethical values. New Horizon schools strive to foster a dedication to God through virtuous living in a progressive Islamic environment. And they share a vision to develop in each student a positive identity as an American Muslim who is prepared with intellectual, social, emotional, spiritual, and physical skills to flourish in tomorrow's world. These are lofty goals, but they are attainable with the right combination of outstanding faculty, robust academic and extracurricular programs, and personalized attention. New Horizons teachers are put through a rigorous selection process to ensure that only the most talented and dedicated teachers are part of the New Horizons staff. And with an average of one teacher to every 15 students, interaction and learning are maximized. Challenging academic programs and activities are only a part of the unique New Horizon experience.
We look to the essence of the Islamic education, the backbone of Islamic education.
Along with traditional classes, New Horizon offers education in Arabic and Islamic studies, subjects unavailable in most elementary schools. New Horizon is also committed to enhancing education with the right tools, like an expansive library, science lab, and computers and audiovisual equipment in every classroom. But a list of the classes and tools available to students won't show you the other lessons students receive during their years at New Horizon. There is no class called character building, but New Horizon students learn all about it. You also won't find classes on honesty, responsibility, ethical decision making, or self-discipline. But New Horizon students will learn that too. The result is a stimulating learning environment where exploration, innovation, and self-discovery are developed within the constructs of ethical and moral values. And amidst all this, you'll notice something else very special about New Horizon. Students are proud to be American Muslims. They're proud of their diverse heritages. They're committed to their families, community, and their country.
For our community, I promise you that your children will be given the best academic and Islamic education they can get in the best public and private schools. They will be well prepared to become the future leaders in America.
The New Horizon experience is unlike any other. It offers a nurturing, caring environment that welcomes young minds and hearts to experience quality education firmly established in high moral values. Join the many people, both Muslims and non-Muslims, in this community who have supported the building of this dream. We want to be sure that the doors to the New Horizon Elementary School...
Thank you very much. You need to understand that we have been watching a CD on computer, and although we had a little technical problem at the beginning, I think it was a great presentation. And thank you, Brother Omar, for that presentation. I think very interesting and informative for the audience to know that something of this nature happening right in Southern California. One of the questions I heard you mention there that it's one of 4 schools, so it's the 4th one. Was it preceded by other schools, and where are they? And give me some history of that.
The New Horizons schools were established in 1984, and the oldest among them is in Pasadena right now. And it started as a preschool with about 16 students. And now the school in Pasadena has about 266 students.
266.
Yeah, and it's the largest of the 4. There is another one, like as I had mentioned, attached or actually inside the Islamic Center of Southern California in downtown Los Angeles, and then the third one is in West Los Angeles, which was built approximately 7 years ago, I believe. And then, of course, there's the Irvine campus, which just opened in September last year.
West LA, is it in Santa Monica area?
Around the Santa Monica area, yeah.
One of the questions, in keeping with our discussion that we had thus far about mosques and centers of learning and so on, this is primarily the reason why I brought up this idea, and I felt it's very important, because it's a very major step in the Islamic community, and of course it's very well known.
this idea of the mosque and the and the school. This is from where the whole idea of stemming of having this program, this part of the program. The idea that that it was linked to a mosque, was it originally linked to a mosque? I mean, did it emanate from a mosque? The whole idea.
Well, the parent organization for the New Horizon Schools is the Islamic Center of Southern California. And so, which is generally what you find is the trend. You know, usually you have a masjid or some sort of Islamic center, and then the next phase is a school. Almost always you'll find whenever there's a masjid that's been around or an Islamic center that's been around for a significant amount of time, sometimes within a very short amount of time, you'll suddenly find some sort of educational facility. It may be manifested in weekend school, but
Sunday classes,
Saturday classes of that sort. However, there are many that have actually developed into full-time schools like the New Horizon schools.
Now, what was the purpose of the Islamic Center? Of course, I mean, on the one hand, there are schools available. Why would they find the need to start a school of this nature? By the way, is the school open to anybody? Can only to Muslims, or is anybody welcome to attend?
It's open to anyone, Muslim and non-Muslim alike, including our teaching staff. We're not specific that the teacher must be Muslim to teach there.
So at your school, do you have Christian teachers, for example? Do you have a Christian teacher?
We do, actually. We have about three of them now.
Oh, three Christian. Okay, yeah. Fine. So it's open, in other words, even
absolutely.
The teaching staff. So people are taken on there.
The Pasadena campus has Jewish teachers as well. I mean, there's a good mix of the different religions at the schools.
Depending on the expertise, of course.
Absolutely. The priority really is placed on, if we want to have an excellent academic program, we need to have excellent teachers. And as the video indicates, the teachers go through a rigorous training and yes. screening process yes. to make sure that we really have the best possible teacher for the position.
Yeah. Now, the question I'd like to ask here is that the whole idea of the school itself, why is there a need? Why was there a need for school? I mean, you have a 200, I think in the four schools, about 400 kids, 300 to 400 kids in the four schools.
Just about.
There are schools. Why did you need those schools? What is the focus of these schools?
Well, if you look at the mission of the New Horizons schools, there's one particular part of it that's very important, and I would say it's kind of the guiding principle, and that it's a positive identity as an American Muslim. Mm-hmm. And you really find that there's a need for Muslim young students in the United States on the one hand, see themselves as Muslims with a very strong set of values, which we, of course, believe to be universal,
right.
While at the same time, active members and participants of the American society. So they're just as much American citizens as they are Muslim, or if you
yes.
prefer, just as much Muslim citizens as Americans,
yes.
Muslims as they are American
yeah.
citizens.
Yeah, this concept of the American Muslim identity, which you have mentioned, for example, do you find it was lacking? Do you find that it was absent in some way?
What we tended to find, and a good example of that is myself. You know, when I was raised, they didn't have Muslim schools. I think the Pasadena campus in 84, I was just old.
Don't mention your age.
Sorry.
Hannah is 45 or 50 something.
at any rate, I was raised through the public school system, and I was raised with somewhat of an identity as a Muslim,
mm-hmm.
But I was consistently seen as something different, something unusual, mm-hmm. and it was very hard to be raised with a sense of confidence in who I was.
Mm-hmm.
And let alone that, there's a much bigger duty that we try to ingrain in our students, which is a sense of responsibility, social responsibility, which doesn't exist in the public schools, and it's even much harder to find in certain private schools, and it's much harder to find in Muslims that will attend non-Muslim schools. Although they may have a strong family background or maybe a very tight connection to a masjid or an Islamic center, mm-hmm. which tends to help, as it did help in my case, but I really and I truly feel that the identity that the students are developing at the New Horizons schools,
mm-hmm.
even as young elementary school students,
mm-hmm.
is much higher than the identity I had even coming out of high school. There's that sense of that they are Muslim, they're proud to be Muslim,
mm-hmm.
and that not only is there something not unusual about being Muslim, but there's actually a sense of responsibility that goes along with that. And when I say responsibility, it's more than just a responsibility towards the society and making it a better place, starting with themselves, but it's also a sense that as Muslims we're dedicated to education, we're dedicated to being the smartest students, to being the most successful in life, to pursuing the extended career. This all falls into... To benefit society, ultimately, of course. This all falls under what we consider the American Muslim identity. Mm-hmm. That as Muslims we contribute to society. Mm-hmm. And this is, if you will, the training ground for something mm-hmm. of that sort. Mm-hmm. Preparing them to be leaders of society, people who will... be role models mm-hmm. of not only good character, good behavior, mm-hmm. but of excellent, strong study skills and academic skills. Yeah.
So, I mean, there's a strong emphasis on the ethical and moral values. I think that I was watching the snippet that you're not teaching. You made a point, I see, in the video of the CD there, the video we saw. You're not teaching this character building and so on and so forth as a subject, but it's taught. Could you elaborate maybe on that somewhat?
Well, it's there. Excuse me. It's there. Throughout the curriculum, throughout the school day.
I mean, it's intertwined. It's embedded in it.
It's intertwined. You know, a perfect example is I walked into a science classroom where the subjects of math and science are taught.
Right.
And on the wall, I saw a very interesting sign that the teacher had put together. Mm. And it said, use religion as your steering wheel, not your spare tire. You know, and so, and then also many other teachers will, we have values, every month we focus on a particular value. Mm-hmm. The value this month in particular is generosity. Mm-hmm. We have values like honesty, responsibility. Mm-hmm. Like I mentioned before, they're universal values. Mm-hmm. And what you'll find throughout the curriculum is that these values are intertwined and somehow included mm-hmm. in the daily activities or the activities of that week, which will include stories that they read, art projects that they'll do, and even the decorations of the classroom.
You mentioned like value of the month now. I mean, elaborate on that. I mean, I find it very interesting. I mean, what do you mean value of the month? Okay, generosity. Like, so what about generosity? Do you raise funds? What do you do? I mean, how do you imbibe? Are they taught some things? Do they memorize things? Or are they practically doing some? What I mean, how do you teach that? I mean, what?
In terms of, I mean, an example would be generosity. So every week, or throughout the month, I should say, it's not necessarily on a weekly basis, but throughout the month, we focus on different aspects of generosity. Mm-hmm. A good example is that if we just say generosity, it's not enough, but we actually go through and explain that there are different ways of being generous. Mm-hmm. You can be generous through giving money, through giving clothing, through giving food, but even a smile is a form of charity. Mm-hmm. You know, giving somebody the respect, giving somebody good sound advice is a form of generosity.
A helping hand.
Okay. So we elaborate on the concept throughout the month. Mm-hmm. So when I mean the focus of the month is mm-hmm. generosity, mm-hmm. that's what it means, is that we pull out the interworkings. On top of that, mm-hmm. in the Quran class that they take, they will memorize and learn about the meanings of verses mm-hmm. specifically referring to generosity.
Okay.
So it's not just rote memorization, mm-hmm. and on top of that, it's not just memorizing a verse but not understanding what it means.
Okay.
The idea is that they're empowered mm-hmm. by learning not only a verse from the Quran that refers to generosity, but knowing the actual meaning of it. Okay. And and this is the goal of our Arabic program, mm-hmm. that they understand the meaning through the understanding of the Arabic language, mm-hmm. not because someone has translated it for them.
Okay.
First-hand access. So in essence, we've created the identity of you're responsible for your learning, mm-hmm. and that you can't rely on someone else to teach you, so to speak, or mm-hmm. to translate it for you. Mm-hmm. It's really the burden, in a sense, is placed on them by teaching them the language of mm-hmm. the Quran. And it's not, the Arabic language isn't taught for any type of cultural yes. affiliation, yeah. Because we have more non-Arabs than Arab students.
Yeah, I'll ask a question about that. I mean, who are the people, are they primarily Arab or Pakistani, or who are the constituents of the students? I mean, how many nationalities, are all American? Or
the list is really very long. I mean,
they're all American, obviously, they're living here, but I mean, from background, where are they originally?
We've got, like you mentioned, there's Pakistani, there's Indian, there's from all of the Arab countries, all put it together. We've got students from Europe, including places like Bosnia. Of course, we've got African American students as well, which constitute, you know, half of the percentage of Muslims in America. Yeah. You've got American born from American parents, converts mm-hmm. Whose children are attending. We have even Hispanic students mm-hmm. From Hispanic origin whose parents are Muslim. Mm-hmm. And then, like you had brought our attention to earlier, there are some non-Muslim students there as well,
yes.
from different backgrounds.
I went to a Catholic school, by the way, in South Africa. So I mean, it was the best school. So I'm trying to say sometimes this imparting of values are very important, and it didn't spoil me. The Catholic school did a good job with me. I think I hope so. I don't know what my mom says about that. but nonetheless. But I find it very interesting, you know, this idea about, we're looking at a Muslim, an Islamic school somewhat, right? The name New Horizon is a neutral name, doesn't give it's an Islamic name or Arabic name.
Sure.
I think maybe that's the reason to be open to everyone. But I find it very interesting, this idea that, it's not like a religious school teaching religious, ideology only. I mean, is the religion more an ideological framework, or is it more teaching of religion? Is it a religious school? Is it instead of religious?
I mean, people are going to define religious schools in different ways, depending on
how would you define your school?
You know, the way I would define my school is an academic school. Very often, the media or other people will ask questions like, what is the Muslim school going to do? You know, is the Muslim school going to close on September 11th and 12th and 13th? Mm-hmm. And the response is very simple. What do all of the other American schools do? Mm-hmm. And that's really how we identify ourselves. We identify ourselves as any other American independent school. Mm. The difference is we have a framework of morals and values, as do many independent and some even some public schools. Mm. But the source for those morals and values are from the one God. Mm. And when you look at those values, it doesn't isolate us in any way. Mm. Because as I'd mentioned, we use values that are universal. Mm. Things like responsibility, things like generosity,
honesty.
Kindness.
Honesty.
Yes. And they continue thankfulness. Every month there's a different one. I'm afraid so far we only have 10 values, but if we decide to extend the school year, we'll have to put in a couple more.
There are many more. Well, the other thing I want to ask is the whole issue of, is this idea of developing an Islamic, American Muslim identity, is it different from what preceded before? Developing that identity, wasn't that identity there before? I mean, why are you saying, are you developing the identity into the youth right now? Or do you need to develop an identity for Muslims like that? I mean, was it there before or hasn't it been there before? What do you mean by developing?
I think you usually find people on different extremes, or at least the argument always tends to go into different extremes when in reality people don't fit on one side or the other.
Right.
On one extreme you have people that feel that Islam has nothing in common with American values or what's going on. It doesn't fit into the American hodgepodge, so to speak. But in reality, it's very erroneous. I mean, Islam very much has a place in American society, in the American pluralism. And when we talk about an American Muslim identity, that's what we're putting our finger on. It's that you are a part of the society. And that you are not something strange or something different. And do not allow anyone to make you think that. Because that's exactly what America is based on. Different ideas, different backgrounds, different cultures, but more specifically, different ways of thinking. And ultimately, these ways of thinking are what make America as wonderful as it is.
I was in my class this week, for example, and we were discussing it at Kelsey Domingo Hills in my Monday class, I think. Yesterday morning, in fact, and I asked my students, will a typical American in my class be stand up? We have such a variety of people from different shades of color, different background. And if you ask an American to stand up, who would be the American? I mean, it's not to say that you have 50 of one and the two of the other. We become the other. The other has become us. We need to understand that. That's very significant. We need to learn. And I find it so fascinating what you are doing and trying to do and succeeding in doing is exactly that. That you're ideologically Muslims and you are morally, ethically abiding by universal principles. But geographically, you recognize the reality of being American. And you need to understand that. So one of the other things that I hear from what you are saying is that the idea of participating fully in the pluralism of America, in the benefits that there is. Of course, if there are things that are problematic, you would voice your criticism and opinion like every other American could do. Playing a larger role. I think one of the problems you mentioned early on, a remark you made which stuck in my head, and I was going to take you on that. You said, for example, some people build centers. Very rarely, but sometimes because they were homesick, so they built a mosque or a center which would remind them of home, and they would go there and meet the same kind of people with the same kind of background and so on, which is not the purpose of the mosque, by the way, at all. So do you think that, the first generation, second generation, maybe you're thinking that's our real home and we are just here temporarily or as long as we are needed or whatever it is. Now people, like yourself, were you born here?
I was born here, and I live my entire life here.
You know what, entire life.
I very easily identify myself as being an American before anything else.
Yes.
Although I may have parents from a particular background, I don't deny that.
So geographically, you are American, but ideologically, you are a Muslim. And you and those two are identities which flow within your very being.
Sure.
You
know? I mean, just as much as being. A former UCLA alumni and being an American student flow together. I mean,
yes.
they're one and the same.
Yes.
There's no area of disagreement in terms of that.
Okay.
Being an American has to do with what you identify with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, being a Muslim has to do with ideologies you hold true and value.
And who you are.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. So the point I'm trying to get, I find really fascinating that what the idea of developing identities. In other words, is forward looking. In other words, it's like a forward looking thing. It's not a matter of forefathers came from Africa or from Timbuktu or from Cairo or wherever it is, as great as the places were and as they may be. You are here now and you are born here. Some people are third, fourth generation, for example. So is part of your, from what I hear, is it really having a larger stake in the pluralism of America? I mean, because I think sometimes people are still, even in many other communities, not only Muslim communities, I find, are still not fully participating.
Absolutely. I mean, you look at the percentage of people who participate in the last election. We're talking, I think, it was something less than 20%. It was an astounding number of people are not. They really don't care. Which is really sad, and I mean to put the political process or the election process aside from things, a lot of people don't even care that there are homeless people in downtown Los Angeles,
mm-hmm.
or that there's a homeless person living next door to them,
mm-hmm.
and being involved in what's going on and having an active role in changing that society,
mm-hmm.
or changing problems like that, is what we're trying to get these students to focus on.
So are you also one of the things that you emphasize on ethical and moral values? And social values and social commitment, is it one of the things that you highlight in your program?
But definitely. I mean, they all need to feel a sense of. Let me give you an example. We had two students who had come to teach a course to all of our grades, and the course was called "The Role of the Citizen," and it told them what does it mean to be a citizen, and they engaged them in different activities, including being involved in their neighborhood, introducing themselves to their neighbor. Some different activities that essentially define to the student and help the student really get a sense of what it means to be a citizen and how to be a citizen.
Okay.
And this is something you don't hear of. And
yes.
And interestingly enough,
mm-hmm.
one of the goals of the public school system is to produce citizens.
Mm-hmm.
Yet we frequently see that as being something that they're producing.
Okay. Now, one of the things that we need to look at is, of course, with the plethora of misinformation and also of stereotyping and so on, which is going on. I mean, initially I found the media, and we dealt with the media a few weeks ago here, and we had someone from the Council of American Islamic Relations from K, Sister Sabiha, who did an excellent job in explaining the role of the media and so on. Initially, you found that some of the media was very sympathetic and said, look, be careful not to be stereotypical and so on and so forth. And some, not so much the TV, though some of them do. ABC does a good job generally. But some of the other channels, and especially on the radio, I mean, you find it's almost a free-for-all against Islam. You can say whatever you want to, and those barbaric people. And even some people now referring to the war in Afghanistan, they would even refer to the enemies. So this idea of not only the enemy of who they are attacking, but also the idea of us having this idea of synonymity with the idea of the Muslim faith somewhat, it's causing a lot of problems. How did the school react to September 11th? Where were you in September 11th at that time? Where were you in your history?
Well, September 11th was our second day of school.
Oh, you opened this year?
We opened September 10th.
Oh,
exactly.
Okay, fine.
So this was obviously a bit of strain for us, and we had an emergency meeting with the board and the directors, and really I think that's where we really cemented and we proved our role as a school that is an American school.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, we made our decisions based on what the other schools did. when the public schools raised their flags from half mast to full mast, we did that. If you recall, the first Friday following the September 11th, there was a national Pledge of Allegiance. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if you recall that. We participated in that. All of our students came for a special assembly Friday, that Friday after September 11th, mm-hmm. to have a Pledge of Allegiance. Mm-hmm. Our students would make prayers for the people who had died because of the attacks.
How has the response of the community been, the general community, I mean, not the Muslim community, I mean the non-Muslim community towards your school in particular? I mean.
Surprisingly enough, and maybe I'm a bit optimistic, and my hope is that I'm accurate in my assessment, I've seen a lot of progress in society. A good example is if you look back several years to the Oklahoma City bombing, mm-hmm. which wasn't even, had nothing to do with Islam or terrorism or Muslims.
It had nothing to do with terrorism, by the way.
Oh, I'm sorry. It had a lot to do with terrorism. You're yes. absolutely correct. Mm-hmm. Yet even within the first 48 hours when it was still unclear, mm. the terrible response and reaction to the Muslim community that had happened based on pure speculation mm. and no evidence whatsoever. Mm. And then even afterwards, mm. when it was shown that Muslims had nothing to do with it, mm. there was no sense of remorse. Mm-hmm. And I had felt it, you know, back then as young as I was. Mm. Yet after September 11th, we received more phone calls to the school welcoming us to the community, showing a sense of remorse for the ignorant reactions people were having towards Muslims around California as well as the United States. And we actually had a particular woman who had visited us, I believe, on three different occasions to bring us flowers, yes. welcoming us to the community. All of these non-Muslim, by the way. We received no death threats. We received a couple of uncomfortable phone calls. And I believe that the city did an excellent job of making us feel welcome, making us feel comfortable, considering we were brand new. Mm-hmm. Yet they knew where we were. Mm-hmm. They knew that we may be a little bit uneasy, and they did an excellent job of providing patrol cars there during our arrival and our dismissal time. Within minutes after I had even heard of the attacks, mm-hmm. we had some police officers come, and they had staked out nearby the school just to make sure things weren't, you know, strange things weren't brewing in terms of the community response to us. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, like I had mentioned, the many examples of people. We got a particular card from a young girl, and that's really the most significant part of it, was she had been in a restaurant, and among the people in the restaurant was a woman who was covered.
And there was in
hijab.
Yeah, in garb, yes. Yeah.
And obviously a Muslim mm. Through her attire. And so...
Either Muslim or a Catholic nun.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
And what had happened was another person in the restaurant had gone to this woman and had said some very harsh words and cruel words to her, causing the woman to cry. And the girl felt so bad, you know, that she had gone to the woman and tried to comfort her to make her feel better. To no avail, the woman was obviously very distressed and very hurt. But the girl was not satisfied. She actually wrote a card to our school because of the, you know, how overwhelmed she had been at
the incident
mm-hmm. and the desire to reach out to somebody. It really hit her at that moment, mm-hmm. and mind you, the girl was about 11 years old who had witnessed this, and yet she felt this desire to reach out to the Muslim community just to let them know in some way, because she felt like she hadn't been able to make this woman feel comfortable. She had assumed maybe as a school or as an organization we had been under some sort of attack. Yeah. And she, once again, it came with flowers and with a card, and we had had it on display. And like I mentioned before, maybe I'm a little bit too optimistic, but I really feel like as a country, mm-hmm. I'm happy to say that we've come a long way. Mm-hmm. And although there are still going to be the ignorant, mm-hmm. and those numbers will still increase and we still need to be wary of them, mm-hmm. I feel like there's an increasing number of people that are more sensitive, more educated, mm-hmm. you know, in being able to see an organization for what it is. Mm-hmm. And the numerous non-Muslims, including the mayor of Irvine, who've come to see our school, are more and more convinced that as a school we are a service to the community, mm-hmm. we are a service to society, and we're clearly identifying the ways that we will benefit the society as a whole, not through transformation, you know, making everybody Muslim or anything mm-hmm. aggressive mm-hmm. Of that sort, mm-hmm. but really bringing about positive social change mm-hmm. through simply exemplifying issues of empathy and respect for others, mm-hmm. and kindness and consideration.
How did the children react to the September 11th thing? I mean, how was their response? I think one of the things that I always view, at least early on, maybe around November, December, there were quite a few programs on television and on radio also, dealing with the issue of how the trauma that some of the kids suffered or something like that. And of course, many of the kids were desensitized because they didn't really see it or they weren't really aware exactly what it was. Some may think like a kind of a movie or something like that. But was there any problems that you encountered with kids or parents in that way that, you know, that you deal with?
You know, more than anything, I think there was just the same trauma everyone else had felt. Mm. You know, that sense of insecurity. Mm. However, for Muslims, it was doubly so. Mm. Because we know that the terrorist attacks of September 11th did not discriminate against Muslim or non-Muslim. Mm.
Yes.
Muslims were victims just as much as non-Muslims.
Yes.
And so...
And then the association by guilt. If you're Muslim... People who may have done it may be Muslim,
yeah.
So you are linked with them in that way also.
So you're doubly in concern, yeah. for your safety and security.
Yes.
Fortunately, we were able to, you know, kind of quell those fears fairly well. We had security, we had 24-hour security, we had, like I mentioned, the police department had been around.
But you never really needed them, did you? I mean,
we never needed them.
There was never
an incident whatsoever of any kind,
yes.
where the police were called out because of a disturbance,
yeah.
Or that our security guards were, had to actually act in any way.
Yeah. Let's bring me to another question. I mean, this is quite interesting. I mean, because this whole idea of the social behavioral science causes how, you know, Islam as a culture and civilization impacted on the world as such, and how it continues to do so. But at the same time, how communities are developing and how we understand one another. And one of the first programs I did was, the first program, in fact, was, why study an ideology other than your own? It's only when you know others, when you know yourself, for that matter.
Mm, of course.
You know, that you know your Lord and you know the others, and you can... And also at the same time, I think, you know, ignorance breeds intolerance and understanding breeds tolerance. Does your school, beyond the September 11th now, do you have, for example, interaction between other schools or other institutions? Do you have like maybe sport or academic or just a teacher in visitation? Or even, for example, perhaps maybe teacher training programs where you have, you know, whatever. Do you have kind of interaction with other schools which may not be Muslim or things of that nature at a school level, I mean?
In terms of the Irvine School, we're a bit young, but nevertheless, we've actually already established a relationship with the local Jewish school. Mm-hmm. And I know the Catholic Church around the corner has also come to visit us. Mm-hmm. So we've actually, considering how young we are, we've established some really great foundations.
6 months, 7 months.
All of these communications happened within the first 2 or 3 months.
Yeah.
In fact, one of the visitors we had gotten to show their support of us being there and hopes that we weren't under any kind of attack was the local Catholic Church. Something that I think was very historic that had occurred this year was the California Association of Independent Schools had worked with our Pasadena campus to put together an event known as A Conversation About Islam.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very well organized and well sponsored.
Organized by whom?
The California Association of Independent Schools.
Okay.
It's the governing body for the private schools in California. To call it a governing body isn't exactly accurate because not all independent schools subscribe to it. However, it's known that the schools that subscribe to it are very prestigious and very good schools, and we're fortunate enough to be one of the only Muslim schools that are accredited by the California Association of Independent Schools, CIS as it's called.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So they put together this program called A Conversation About Islam, where they invited members, representatives, principals, board members from all of the independent schools in Southern California, and they created roundtables,
mm-hmm.
that had people from other schools, non-Muslim schools, as well as representatives from the Islamic Center and its community, to essentially have a conversation about Islam. There were, of course, presentations, but most of the time was spent answering questions.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially what you're talking about, establishing those relations, bridging those gaps, and identifying New Horizons School just as an independent school as much as all of those other, as much as the other independent schools that are part of CIS are. In terms of involvement with other organizations, in Pasadena there were many opportunities where students would, as part of their community service, would volunteer in local organizations. For example, the Head Start organization, which is for children before kindergarten, they would volunteer there. There was also a school for students with severe mental and physical disabilities, and our students would go there to volunteer as well as part of a course that they took at the school. Mm-hmm. So there is that connection to the community. There is that connection to what you would consider non-Muslim organizations mm-hmm. as part of their existence. In a lot of ways, the school is a hub to connect Muslims to organizations outside of the school.
Okay.
And I was actually even thinking and reflecting about our discussion about masjids and how it relates to schools. In so many ways, the school is like a masjid. Mm-hmm. You know, you think about it. People come together. Mm-hmm. It's a small community mm-hmm. where people interact and learn from one another.
Moral social values.
There's that transmission of knowledge. Exposure to different ideologies, different cultures.
Okay.
That lack of bias, you know, that location to be able to learn how to as well as resolve conflicts. The parallels are evident, mm-hmm. But most importantly is the significance that a school has in a community.
My last question, because we have very limited some of time left. Before I go into the concluding remarks, normally a mosque has a center attached to it.
Yeah.
And you know, as you mentioned, that the New Horizon system.
You mean a school has a center attached to it?
Sorry, what did I say?
A
school is normally attached to a mosque or something of that nature in Islamic history and traditionally and so on. And our discussion has been about that in the early part of this program today. But at the same time, you mentioned that the New Horizon School has been a brainchild and somewhat an offspring of the Islamic Center of Southern California, which is in downtown Los Angeles. And you are the fourth in that line of family. You are the newborn, very newborn. I mean, I'm surprised you are walking after 6 months. teething problems, I'm sure you have some teething problems. But but you are not attached, you are where you are right now, you're not at a mosque, you are just a madrasa, you're only at a school.
Correct.
Right.
It kind of ties out to what I'd mentioned before about this concept of attachment. Mm. You know, in a lot of ways, the distance between your house and mine in some parts of the world would necessitate us being in two separate countries.
Right.
I mean, yes. We would be two different cultures.
Yes.
I mean, there are certain parts of the world where the concept of community is strictly dependent on geographical integrity.
Yes.
In the age of the internet and cell phones and this
global village,
you've got a global village. I mean, a perfect example is you look at the mailing list of the Islamic Center of Southern California. It extends throughout LA and Orange County, Northern mm-hmm. LA County, South Orange County, and all of these are considered a part of the community of Muslims involved with the Islamic Center. In addition to that, there is the other organizations that the Islamic Center has, which are not attached to the Islamic Center. For example, there's MPAC, the Muslim Public Affairs Council.
Yes.
There are the four schools.
Yes, yes.
So I really feel that if we redefine the meaning of attachment mm-hmm. to not mean stuck together physically or mm-hmm. juxtaposed physically, then these schools are very much still attached
yes.
to that. And then there's other sense, you know, really to pull in this idea of global village, just because the New Horizon schools stem from the Islamic Center of Southern California doesn't mean it's detached mm-hmm. from all of the other centers.
Yes, yes.
I mean, one of the most notable is the presence of the Islamic Center of Irvine, which is opening right next door.
Mm-hmm. So normally you find the mosque gave impetus to the madrasa or the school,
and now the
Islamic Center of Irvine will be directly opposite next to the mosque?
Exactly.
I mean, next to the school?
Next to the school, exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, they've begun construction already, and I believe it's supposed to be finished within the next 9 months.
Yeah, so the idea is that here you see the school sort of
the precursor, know, to the
precursor to the mosque, so it's intertwined.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But in a lot of ways, you know, that masjid will also bring in many people
yes.
that the school has been trying to bring in. So it really it's creating an interesting community there.
So the New Horizons School of Irvine give an impetus, and then you have Islamic Center of Irvine, and they can feed on one another.
Absolutely.
Though the Islamic Center, which is developing there, finds it ideal that, you know, there's a school being built there, so, you know, the presence is enhanced, that a part of something which would be part of a traditional mosque is already established.
Absolutely.
You know, it's like having the basketball court already set up. Well, now here we have a ground around it for sport and recreation. We thank Brother Omar Izzeddin very, very much. I just want to give a concluding remarks about what we have discussed somewhat. And also to inform you that next week is a holiday, and I need a break, by the way. So we won't be having any discussion or any program next week. But the week thereafter, we will be having the next class. So in other words, 14 days from tonight, on Tuesday, a fortnight from tonight, we'll resume our program. It will be session 8, I think. It will be on Islamic culture and civilization, the SBS 318 course, conducted here by yours truly, Sadullah Khan. And also, I'll be giving you your assignment at that time as well. So please keep a pen and paper ready then at that time. What I wish to just briefly look at is what we have discussed somewhat here today. We have looked at the mosque as a comprehensive center. We have looked at it as an expression of Islamic civilization and a manifestation of an Islamic presence as well, an expression of Islamic art and architecture at its highest level. And we've also realized that during the peak of Islamic civilization, the mosque or the masjid was an institution of learning to produce brilliant scholars and scientists. And today we still find the intertwining of Islamic learning, Islamic ethos, Islamic values still being attached, and learning and intellectual development still attached to many mosques and centers. And today, as we know, Islam is the fastest growing major monotheistic religion, and consequently more mosques have been built worldwide, and more specifically in America is the fastest growing faith in America, as well as the second largest religion in America. New places of worship are being built in every neighborhood virtually for the followers of that faith, as well as serving as a center and access for the community. A fact that should be borne in mind is that in contemporary modern society, the mosque serves as a single most important visible representation of Muslim identity and values, and that together with the school, as we have seen. This may and often does take an what you can call an emblematic form, you know, an emblematic form, some kind of emblem, as in the case of the large state-sponsored national mosque in Muslim countries, or as a symbol of offering emotional support in a Western country or in a country where Muslims may be minority. Now, although mosques and Islamic centers cater for organized religion, so to say, they meet other needs as well. The mosque functions as a social center, as we heard from our guest and from the snippets that we have seen on television, where the community meets for a variety of events that help to cement relationship and to provide communal celebrations. It has become the center for Islamic knowledge and education and for general learning, where Islam is taught and Islamic values are taught and imparted, imbibed and imparted to the next generation, and where people can reflect on the meaning of Islam in the new environment they find themselves. The mosque has also become an island of sanity where people's humanity is respected, a haven of security where their self-esteem is restored, where they can find respite from the harassment, discrimination and humiliation of the social environment where they may find there to be such harassment or discrimination or humiliation. It is a value for it's a venue for sharing of experiences, the ratification of norms and the validating of values. A place where people's identity is affirmed and reaffirmed in the community of friends and family, and most important, in the company of people of a similar faith, of the same faith. People who are ideologically Muslims and geographically Americans. As such, the mosque has become a center for the confirmation as well as the dissemination of shared social and cultural values, where community is forged and formalized, where common concerns and visions are shared and reaffirmed. The mosque structure has become the primary symbol, not only of the presence of Islam in the West, but of the permanence of its future in this part of the world and wherever mosques are established. We have a beautiful mosque, a beautiful picture of a beautiful mosque in New York, which we will show you and we will play out with that. We hope you enjoyed the program as much as we enjoyed presenting it. On behalf of myself, Sadullah Khan, your instructor, and my dear friend Omar Izzeddin, the director and co-principal of the New Horizon Elementary School in Irvine, we thank you. We bid you peace. Peace be unto you. See you in a fortnight, and good night.